The Lost World. Francis DeWolf, Kevin McHugh, Gerald Harper, and Carlton Hobbs in a three-part serial adapted from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's novel by Peggy Wells and Barry Campbell. Part 1. The Monster of Enmore Park. London, 1907.
It all began quietly enough in the little parlour of a house at Streatham. For an hour or more that evening, I had been forced to listen to Mr. Hungerton, the father of the girl I loved. He seemed to believe that I came round to the Chestnuts 3 days a week, simply for the pleasure of his company, to hear him talk about bad money driving out good and the true standards of exchange. However, now I was alone with Gladys at last, and the moment of fate had come. There Gladys sat, aloof as a goddess, the dreamy look in her eyes and her profile outlined against the red curtain. How beautiful she was, and how very remote. But come what might, I must speak.
You're looking very thoughtful, Ned.
Gladys, I mean to say...
I have a feeling you are going to propose, Ned. I do wish you wouldn't. Things are so much nicer as they are.
How did you know I was going to propose?
Oh, don't women always know? Oh, Ned, what a pity to spoil our friendship. Don't you feel how splendid it is that we can talk face to face as we have talked?
Well, I can talk face to face with the station master. But that doesn't satisfy me in the least. I want...
No, Ned, stop. You've spoiled everything. It's all so beautiful and natural until this kind of thing comes in. It's such a pity.
It's nature. It's love.
Well, perhaps if both love, it may be different. I have never felt it.
Why can't you love me, Gladys? What's wrong with me?
I'm in love with somebody else, Ned.
Tell the truth, Gladys. I was afraid of that.
Oh, no, Ned, please don't look like that. It's nobody in particular.
Nobody in particular? But you said...
It's an ideal, Ned. A glorious, magnificent ideal. Oh, this man I'm thinking about, I wish I could describe him to you.
Well, what does he look like? What does he do that I can't do?
Please, Ned.
Teetotaler, vegetarian, theosophist, Superman. By George, I'll even have a shot at flying the channel. Just tell me what would please you.
In the first place, Ned, I don't think my ideal would speak quite like that.
Why not?
He would be harder, sterner. He would be a man who could look death in the face and have no fear. He would be a man of great deeds and strange experiences.
Hang it all, Gladys. I'm Edward Malone, a reporter on the Daily Gazette, earning £3.10 a week. Where would I run into any great deeds and strange experiences?
That's just it, Ned. You're so prosaic.
And you don't want me to be prosaic. Is that it?
Well, my ideal would never be that. He wouldn't be content with the work he happened to be doing. He'd go out and look for adventures. He'd make his own chances. Well, think of Burton. Think of Stanley.
We can't all be Burtons or Stanleys, I'm afraid.
And you, Ned, with your newspaper work. Now, when you described that coal mine explosion last week, why couldn't you have gone down into the pit and helped those people who were trapped?
I did.
You did? But you never said so.
There was nothing worth bragging about.
Oh. I didn't know, Ned. Well, that was brave of you.
I had to. If you want to write good copy, you must be where things are.
Oh, Ned, there it is again. Such a prosaic motive. I dare say I'm being foolish, but it's so real to me, so much a part of myself. If I do marry, I want to marry a famous man.
And why shouldn't you marry a famous man, Gladys? If I get a chance, Gladys, I will...
Please, Ned. Some day, perhaps, when you've won your place in the world, we shall talk it over again.
By George, we will. I'll make a chance, Gladys. I'll tackle my editor first thing tomorrow morning. Old McCardle's not a bad sort. I'm sure he'll help me if he can. Yes, Gladys, I'll make a chance and prove myself worthy of you. You see if I don't.
Come in, come in. Lush lad. You needn't break the door down. What is it?
May I have a very serious word with you, Mr. McCardle?
Lad, what about?
I want to ask you a favor.
Your salary, Mr. Malone, is already...
It wasn't about my salary.
It wasn't about your salary, Mr. Malone. Then what is it about?
I want to break my neck.
What?
Not exactly that, but I want to justify my life. Do you think, sir, you could possibly send me on a special mission for the paper?
Special mission, Mr. Malone? Well, what sort of special mission had you in mind?
Anything with adventure and danger in it. 2,000 miles in a balloon, over the Himalayas, down in the pyramids. You know what I mean?
I'm not sure, Mr. Malone, I do know what you mean. I mean, these special missions are very expensive.
I know that, sir.
And they want a writer with a name that will justify the expense. But I have got a wee assignment for you that may just be the thing. Now, what do you say to a nice interview?
Interview, sir?
Oh, come, lad, you needn't look so dashed. You haven't heard the name of the man you're yet to interview.
Well, sir?
Professor George Edward Challenger of Enmore Park.
Professor Challenger? The famous zoologist.
Aye.
But look here, sir. Isn't that the man who broke the head of the chap from the Daily Telegraph?
Yes.
And threw the Morning Post reporter down 2 flights of stairs?
Yes.
And broke his spectacles and danced on his hat?
Aye, he doesn't like reporters again.
But why do we want an interview with Professor Challenger?
To show up an impostor, Mr. Malone, to expose a modern man chosen, insulting the sacred name of science.
But look here, he's no imposter. He's quite a scientific bigwig. Got a string of degrees after his name, an international reputation.
A grand international reputation. On the last occasion, a debate in Vienna, they had to call on the police. Oh, I've got his record here, with his published works, and a fine, stimulating record that is.
All the same, sir. Why do you call him an imposter?
Because of the South American business.
What South American business?
The Skellum claims to have discovered, a lost world.
A lost world, sir?
A lost world up the Amazon, full of prehistoric monsters and dinosaurs 50 feet high. But it would make a grand exposure story if you could get in to see him.
You think I can't manage to see him, sir?
I don't know, can, Mr. Malone.
You say you've got his published works, sir?
Aye.
What are they?
Some observations upon a series of Kalmuck skulls. Outlines of vertebrae evolution. The underlying fallacy of Weissmanism. And here is an account of the row at Vienna. It was about Weissmanism, if you can what that is.
Give me an account of the row at Vienna.
What do you want to do with it, lad?
Give it to me.
You won't understand 2 words of it.
That doesn't matter. All I want is a sentence.
What sentence?
Any sentence.
Here it is. See for yourself.
Good Lord.
I told you so. Yourn is jargon. Scientific jargon.
This will do. Mr. McCardle, I think I found the answer. I'm going to write a letter.
Dear Professor Challenger, as a humble student of nature, I have always taken the most profound interest in your speculations as to the difference between Darwinism
and Weissmannism. I have recently had occasion to refresh my memory by rereading your masterly address at Vienna. That lucid and admirable statement seems to be the last word on the matter. There is one sentence, however, where you say, I protest strongly against the insufferable and entirely dogmatic assertion that each separate id is a microcosm possessed of an historical architecture.
Elaborated slowly through the series of generations. Have you no desire, Professor, in view of later research, to modify that statement? No. Oh. I have certain suggestions which I can only explain in a personal conversation. With your permission, I trust to have the honor of calling on you at 11 o'clock the day after tomorrow, Wednesday morning. I remain, sir, with assurances of profound respect, yours very sincerely, Edward D. Malone. Oh! Austin! Austin! Where the devil is the fellow?
You called, sir?
Yes, I did. Twice. Now listen. At exactly 11 o'clock this morning, a gentleman calling himself Malone will present himself at the front door and ask to see me.
I understand, sir. I shall send him away.
Don't speak until you're spoken to, sir. You do not understand. When this Mr. Malone arrives, you will show him in. I am rather interested to know just who Mr. Malone is and what Mr. Malone is after. Ha! Modify my opinions, indeed.
Yes, sir?
Good morning. My name is Malone. I have an appointment. Well, a kind of appointment with Professor Challenger.
The professor is expecting you, sir, if you will kindly follow me.
Thank you.
Austin! Austin, did I hear someone at the door?
Yes, madam. A Mr. Malone, madam.
I have an appointment with your...
Shh. Yes, yes, I know. Please, keep your voice down. Oh, dear. Mr. Malone, may I ask, have you ever met my husband before?
No.
Then I must apologize to you in advance and tell you that he is a perfectly impossible person. If you are forewarned, you will be more ready to make allowances.
Allowances?
Yes, yes. Now, get out of the room quickly if he seems inclined to be violent. Don't wait to argue with him. I suppose it wasn't about South America you wanted to see him, was it?
Why, yes, it was.
Oh, dear.
Mrs. Challenger! Mrs. George Edward Challenger!
Oh, there he is now. Yes, George, dear?
I am, I trust, a man of singularly docile and reasonable mind.
Oh, yes, dear, of course!
Yet if there is one thing I cannot abide, it is whispering outside doors. It interrupts my work. And to interrupt my work, I might point out, is scarcely fair to posterity.
I'm sorry, George, dear. It was only that
my work, I fear, is destined to interruption. I am expecting this morning a visitor. I know nothing of this visitor, except that he will be ignorant in mind and perhaps revolting in appearance.
Yeah, wait a minute.
He's just arrived, George, dear. He's here now.
Indeed. I fancied as much. Then be good enough to send him in.
Goodbye, Mr. Malone. After all, well...
Yes, Mrs. Challenger?
You do look big enough to take care of yourself. And remember, just get out of the room if he seems inclined to be violent. And if he starts talking about South America, please don't contradict him. In you go now.
I pushed aside the partly open door and walked, somewhat apprehensively, into the room. The professor was sitting in a swivel chair behind a broad table, which was covered with maps and diagrams. As I entered, he spun round to face me. I was prepared for something strange, but not for so overpowering a personality as this. It was his size which took one's breath away, his size and his imposing presence. His head was the largest I have ever seen upon a human being. He had the face and beard which I associated with that of an Assyrian bull. His eyes, which were blue-gray under great black eyebrows, were very clear, very critical, and very masterful. A huge spread of shoulders and a chest like a barrel were the other parts of him which appeared above the table. And I must confess that his appearance made me gasp with surprise.
Well, young man?
Well, sir.
What do you mean, sir, well, sir? What the devil are you staring at?
Well, sir, you are rather impressive.
Impressive, eh?
Yes, sir.
Well, yes. Yes, perhaps impressive is the right word. Majestic, if I may say so, might
an even better one. But we are not here, young man, to discuss the effect of greatness on its underlings.
No, sir.
You were good enough, I believe, to write me a letter and to approve my general views regarding Weissmanism.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That strengthens my position very much. But you had, I think, some comments to make on the proposition I advanced. Come, come, Mr. Malone, speak up.
I am, of course, a mere student, really just an earnest inquirer.
What comments, Mr. Malone?
It did seem to me you were a little severe on Weissman in this matter. Hasn't the general evidence since that day tended to strengthen his position?
What evidence, Mr. Malone?
I mean, I alluded to the trend of modern thought, to the general scientific point of view. Why are you looking at me like that?
I suppose you are aware, young man, that the cranial index is a constant factor.
Naturally, sir.
Yes. And the question of telegony is still sub judice.
Undoubtedly, sir. I've always said so.
Yes. And the germplasm is different from the parthenogenetic egg?
Why, surely.
But what does that prove?
Ah, what indeed? What does it prove?
Shall I tell you?
Please do.
It proves, sir, that you are the rankest impostor in London, a vile, crawling journalist, here under false pretenses. Gibberish. That's what I've been talking to you, sir. Do you think you could match cunning with me? You, with your walnut of a brain? Why, you infernal scribbler,
I... wait a minute, Professor. Please wait. Sit down.
To say that I would like to cut your heart out and stuff it like a Christmas turkey would be beneath my dignity. I shall begin, therefore, in a more decorous way. You observe this plaster bust of Socrates, which has always seemed to me of somewhat doubtful aesthetic value.
Now, look here, sir. Just let me explain.
I shall begin by discharging this bust with an erring aim at your head.
George! George, what's happening? Stop this at once!
Keep out of this, Mrs. George Edward Challenger. Keep out of this.
I won't keep out of this. George, what on earth are you going to do?
I propose, Mrs. C., to take this young man by the neck and expel him forcibly from the house.
You put your hands on me, sir, and you'll ruddy well wish you hadn't.
Will I so, young man? Will I so?
Keep away from me, Professor. What chance have you got? I'm 15 stone place and to 3/4 every Saturday for the London Irish. I'm not a man.
Mr. Malone! Look out! Austin, open the front door!
The front door is open, madam. I anticipated some such eventuality.
Would you raise your fist to me? I can't help you down the front stairs. Take that, you infernal scribbler.
Oh, my eye!
Blast you!
Get enough! No, you infernal bully! Take that! Oh.
Austin, they'll be killed! They've fallen down the front steps. We must separate them. Come along quickly.
That will not be necessary, madam. I see from the window that both the professor and the young man are on their feet again, and apparently unharmed, except that, oh, dear me, the young man appears to have acquired a black eye.
Well, go and try to persuade the professor to come in at once before someone sends for the police.
That will not be necessary either, madam, since I perceive that there is a constable already on the scene.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Now then, what's all this?
This man attacked me.
You will oblige me, Constable, by removing your obnoxious presence from what I must designate as a purely private scene of acrimony.
I don't know what that means, Professor Challenger, but I do see this young gent with a black eye, and it's not the first time this has happened by a long chalk. Well, sir?
Oh, it's all right. We had a bit of a row. This man let fly at me.
I'll bet he did, sir. He's been doing nothing else for the past 2 years. Do you give him in charge?
Well, I...
Do you give him in charge, sir?
No, I don't.
What's that?
I was as much to blame as he was. I intruded on him. He gave me fair warning.
I see, sir. Well, Professor, don't let's have any more such goings on. Right, move along now. Move along.
An interesting phenomenon. As interesting a phenomenon, indeed, as was ever discovered by GEC in his greatest days. Come back to the house, young man. Come back into the house. I've not finished with you yet. Sit down, Mr. Malone. Take that chair.
Whatever you say, Professor.
May I offer you a cigar?
Thank you.
You're excitable, young man. Very excitable.
I am excitable.
Well, you'll oblige me, young man, by not jumping off again in that impetuous Irish fashion.
Doubtless you've been wondering, with whatever small intelligence you may possess, why I invited you back into the house, eh?
I have been wondering.
Then permit me to tell you. The subspecies of the human race to which you unfortunately belong...
Subspecies of the human race?
Yes, I refer, of course, to the whole tribe of journalists.
All right, don't stick your beard out. I agree.
Oh, you agree to this self-evident truth.
Anybody who got annoyed with you, Professor, would just have to stay annoyed all the time. I agree.
Well, this subspecies, I repeat, has always been beneath my mental notice. But in your reply to that officious policeman a moment ago... I seem to detect signs of a latent good feeling, which raised you somewhat above the level of your revolting clan. I found myself, in short, almost liking you.
Thank you.
You came here, I dare say, for some information about my explorations in South America.
Yes, Professor Challenger, I did.
You will not get that information, young man.
I was afraid of that.
Like Darwin, Galileo, and other great prophets, I have been derided. The word liar applied to George Edward Challenger is offensive to a degree which you, as a journalist, would not appreciate.
All right, all right.
It occurs to me, after several years of patient silence, that the time has come to make some public answer and proposal to my critics.
Answer, sir? What sort of answer?
There will be held this evening a public meeting at the Royal Zoological Institute's hall. Would you care for a seat on the platform among the speakers?
I don't know what you're up to, sir, but I'd appreciate it very much.
It'll be a large meeting, young man, of the utmost dignity and decorum. My presence, of course, will be guarantee of that.
Of course, of course.
The chairman will be the Duke of Durham. The principal speaker will be Professor Summerlee, on the record of the ages. You have perhaps heard of Professor Summerlee?
Good Lord, yes. He's as famous a zoologist as...
As I am, you were about to say.
No, not at all. Nothing like that.
You'll pardon my candor, young man, if I remark that Professor Summerlee has a face like a goat... and his views on the subject of vertebrate evolution would make a cat laugh.
Well, what are you going to do at the meeting, sir?
I am to move a vote of thanks to Professor Summerlee. In doing so...
Yes, sir?
I shall make it my business to point out, with infinite tact and delicacy, where I disagree with Professor Summerlee. If you care to be at that meeting, young man, I fancy that you might find it rather interesting. Yes, rather interesting.
When I arrived at the hall that night, I found a much greater concourse than I had expected. And as soon as I had taken my seat among the bigwigs on the platform, I realized that a youthful and even boyish spirit was abroad in the gallery and at the back of the hall. The medical students were out in force. I don't know what these meetings were usually like, but it struck me that this was a strange prelude to a scientific lecture.
Ladies and gentlemen, quiet, please.
Did you get the battle? Did you get that tile? Is your data lovely, my red boy, that broken style?
Thank you, gentlemen. It is my proud duty to introduce to you tonight's speaker, a man of the highest academic and scientific qualifications, who is, I think, well known to you all, Professor William Summerlee.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I have chosen as my subject tonight evolution.
I say.
And have entitled my lecture...
I say, young fellow, my lad.
Yes? What is it?
Well, excuse me speaking to you and all that, but, I mean, well, you haven't got a beard.
Beard? Why the devil should I have a beard?
Well, deuce take it, all the rest of these chaps have got them. Never saw such a collection of beards in all my born days. You're a bit young, aren't you, to be such a learned sort of bloke?
Good Lord, I don't belong here. I'm a reporter from the Daily Gazette. My name's Malone.
Ah, George, then we're two of a kind. I was feeling a bit nervous myself in all this company. My name's Roxton.
Not Lord John Roxton, the Amazon explorer and big game hunter.
Well, I've done a bit of shooting in my time. I say, watch out, watch out. We're interrupting the old josser.
Thank you, gentlemen. Perhaps I might now be allowed to continue. Science has not succeeded to date in making organic life from inorganic materials. The gulf between the dead and the living is something which our chemistry has not been able to bridge. And in conclusion,
Lord John,
ladies
Dudley,
and gentlemen,
what are you doing here?
I have only these few words.
I heard there was going to be trouble. I wanted to see it. Look at old Challenger over there. He's positively bristling.
I know, but Lord John, but
shh. We have seen the drying of the seas, the emergence of the sandbank, the tendency of the sea creatures to take refuge on the mud flats, the abundance of food awaiting them, and their consequent enormous growth. Hence, ladies and gentlemen, that frightful brood of monsters which still affright our eyes when seen in the wheeling states, but which, fortunately, were extinct long before the appearance of man on this earth.
Question? I deny that statement.
May I inquire, Mr. Chairman, which of the gentlemen on the platform behind me spoke then?
I spoke, sir. George Edward Challenger, at your service.
We want Challenger! We want Challenger! We want Challenger!
Silence, please! Quiet!
Gentlemen, please! You spoke, Professor Challenger.
I spoke, Professor Summerlee.
You are discourteous, Professor Challenger.
You are inaccurate, Professor Summerlee.
I am inaccurate, sir.
You are inaccurate, sir.
In the face of such manifest absurdity, Mr. Chairman, I must ask leave to end my remarks at this point and leave matters to the distinguished Professor Challenger. Perhaps you, sir, will take my place at the reading desk.
I will do that, sir, with the greatest of pleasure.
Oh, bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, I beg pardon. Ladies, gentlemen, and children. I have been selected to move a vote of thanks to Professor Summerlee for the very picturesque and imaginative address to which we have just listened. Popular lectures are the easiest to listen to, but the professor will excuse me when I say that they are necessarily both superficial and misleading, since they have to be graded to the comprehension of an ignorant audience. Now, what is the particular point upon which I, as an original investigator, have challenged our lecturer's accuracy? It is upon the permanence of certain types of animal life upon the earth. Professor Summerlee is very wrong in supposing that because he has never himself seen a prehistoric animal, therefore these creatures no longer exist. How do I know, you ask me? I know because I have visited their secret haunts. I know because I have seen some of them. Am I a liar, do you think? Then I will not detain you. I will merely put you to the test. Now, will you accredit one or more of your own number to go out as your representative and test my statement in your name?
Yes!
Well, Professor Summerlee, will you dare to take part in an expedition to the Lost World to see these creatures?
Yes, I will.
Then I guarantee that I will place in your hands such material as will enable you to find your way. I don't disguise from you that there are difficulties and danger. You will need a younger colleague.
I go, Mr. Chairman, I go.
I volunteer to go. You sit down, young fella.
What is your name, sir?
Edward Malone. I'm a reporter from the Daily Gazette. I claim to be an absolutely unprejudiced witness.
And you, sir, what is your name?
I'm Lord John Roxton.
Lord John Roxton's reputation as a sportsman is world famous. At the same time, it would certainly be well to have a member of the press on such an expedition.
Hmm. Then I move that both these gentlemen be elected as representatives of this meeting to accompany Professor Summerlee on his journey.
Well, young fella, so we're committed.
If I can only get McArdle to stump up expenses.
McArdle? Who's McArdle?
It's my news editor. And Gladys, if only Gladys could see me now.
You'll go, young fella, if I have to stump up expenses myself. By George, I never knew scientific meetings were such lively places, or I'd have come to one long ago. And now, young fella, shake hands.
Shake hands?
To the lost world.
To the lost world.
That night, wearied as I was after the wonderful happenings of the day, I sat with Mr. McArdle explaining to him the whole situation, which he thought important enough to bring to the notice of Sir George Beaumont, our newspaper chief. He agreed that I should be allowed to go on the expedition as the Gazette's representative. There followed such a period of confusion and bustle as I made my preparations for the journey that I barely had a moment to reflect on the enormity of the step that I had taken until some 2 weeks later, when I found myself pacing a wet and glistening dockside in the shadow of the great liner which was to take our expedition to South America. My reflections were soon interrupted, however, by the arrival of my two companions.
Well, young fella, so we're off at long last. And I must confess that I can't wait to get to this lost world of old challenges.
Neither can I.
Have either of you gentlemen had any dealings with the great man since the night of the lecture?
Well, my paper rang him only to be told that he would hand us our last-minute directions just before we left. When I rang to get more information, he abused me roundly, then abused the press in general, and ended up by shattering his telephone receiver.
Well, I'm as much in the dark as you are. I just had a note to say he'd be seeing us all.
I, too, had a similar communication. Ah! And here, if I am not mistaken, comes the great humbug himself.
Well, gentlemen, I am glad to see you all here. I had imagined that the learned professor might have got cold feet.
Well, I really...
Now, I have only a few words to say to you. Firstly, I beg you not to imagine that I am in any way indebted to you for making this journey. Truth is truth, and nothing you report can affect it in any way, though it may excite the emotions and allay the curiosity of a number of very ineffectual people. My directions for your instruction and guidance are in this sealed envelope. You will open it when you reach a town upon the Amazon, which is called Manaus, but not until the date and hour which is written on the outside.
Oh, really? I must protest.
Protest as much as you like. It will do you no good. Now, have I made myself clear? You do not open the envelope until the date and hour which is written on the outside. Here, Lord John, you take it.
Thank you.
I leave the observance of my conditions entirely to your honor. Yes, Malone, what are you fidgeting about?
Well, sir, about my reports. I am anxious.
Mr. Malone, I will place no restrictions upon your reports, since the ventilation of the facts is the object of your journey. But I demand that you shall give no particulars as to your exact destination, and that nothing be actually published until you return.
Very well, Professor.
Now, goodbye, sir. You have done something to mitigate my feelings for the loathsome profession to which you so unhappily belong. Goodbye, Lord John. Science is, as I understand it, a sealed book to you, but you may congratulate yourself upon the hunting field which awaits you. And goodbye to you, Professor. If you are still capable of self-improvement, which I very much doubt, you will return to London a wiser man. Goodbye.
Goodbye, bye. Professor Challenger.
Really? That man is insufferable.
I would not bore those who listen to my story with an account of our luxurious voyage upon the liner, nor will I tell of our week's stay at Para, or of our journey up the wide, slow-moving river in a steamer. Eventually, we found ourselves through the narrows of Obidos and reached the town of Manaus. Here we were rescued from the limited attractions of the local inn by the representative of the British and Brazilian Trading Company. In his hospitable fazenda, we spent our time until the day when we were empowered to open our letter of instruction.
Well, gentlemen, the time is almost here, as you see. Instructions to Lord John Roxton to be opened at Manaus upon July the 15th at 12 o'clock precisely. We've just 1 minute to go.
What difference can it possibly make if we open it now or in 1 minute? It's all part and parcel of the quackery and nonsense for which I regret to say the writer is notorious.
Well, the old dear's very precise. I think perhaps we'd better wait.
He is also thousands of miles away, while we are here on a wild goose chase.
Oh, come on now, play the game. It's his show. Be rotten bad form if we didn't follow his instructions to the letter.
A pretty business this is. It struck me as preposterous in London, and it seems even more so now. I don't know what is inside this envelope, but unless it's something pretty definite, I shall commence the return journey to London immediately.
Oh, come now, Professor Challenger won't let us down, I'm sure. The envelope no doubt contains a map and instructions.
I hope so. But surely it's time now.
Time it is. Now, let's see. Well, there's just one sheet of paper. Good God. It's blank.
Ha! I knew it. It's an open admission. What more do you want? The fellow's a self-confessed humbug. We have but to return home and expose him for the brazen imposter that he is.
Perhaps something is written on it in invisible ink.
Sorry, young fellow. There's no use deceiving ourselves. Oh. It's all off.
It can't be. Look, perhaps there's been a...
May I come in?
God. Oh,
God.
Well, I'll be damned.
I fear that I'm a few minutes late. When I gave you this envelope, it was my intention to be with you before the hour. I never intended that you should open it. Well, gentlemen, you seem surprised to see me.
Well, I am bound to say, sir, that your turning up is a considerable relief. But I can't for the life of me see what... Well, I mean, why you should have worked it in such an extraordinary manner.
Because, gentlemen, there is really only one person who is qualified to lead this expedition... And that person is myself. Now, is all ready for the journey?
Yes, sir. I've engaged two half-breeds from Para, one of whom speaks English. His name's Gomez. They'll act as servants, make themselves generally useful. Besides these, I've hired three Mojo Indians from the river tribes, and a hulking great fella called Zambo. Should be pretty useful. The equipment's been checked, rechecked. We've a steam launch to take us up the river.
Mm-hmm. What about canoes?
We have canoes. In fact, we could start tomorrow, if need be.
I see. And now, gentlemen... I feel that the time has come to let you know a little more of the background to this expedition, so that you can see exactly what you've let yourselves in for. I suggest that you gather round this table and listen carefully. Yeah.
Well, some years ago, I made a journey to South America. It was my business to visit the little-known back country and investigate some of the hitherto unexplored tributaries which run into the main river, in order to examine fauna for my great work on zoology. I was returning, my work accomplished, when I had occasion to spend the night at a small Indian village. The natives were Kukama Indians, an amiable but degraded race, with mental powers hardly superior to the average Londoner. Imagine my surprise when, on entering this village, I was immediately taken to a small hut. There, to my amazement, I discovered the body of a white man who had but recently expired.
Good Lord. Well, how did he get there?
Kindly have the goodness not to interrupt, sir.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
He was clad in rags, very emaciated, and bore every trace of prolonged hardship. As far as I could gather, he was a complete stranger to the natives, and had only recently arrived in the village, in the last stage of exhaustion. From the contents of the man's knapsack, it was obvious to me that... He was an artist and a poet. His name was Maple White, an American, it seems. Well, the knapsack contained scraps of verse which, I must say, appeared to me to be singularly lacking in merit. And there were also some rather commonplace pictures. Such were the total effects of this strange American behemoth.
Good Lord.
I was turning away from him when I noticed something projecting from his jacket. It was this sketchbook, which I now hand to you and ask you to examine page by page. Carefully now. I can assure you that this book is as valuable to me as a first folio of Shakespeare.
Eagerly watched by my companions, I opened the volume with some expectation.
The first page was disappointing, however. It contained nothing but a picture of a fat man in a pea jacket with the legend Jimmy Colver on the mailboat. There followed several pages filled with sketches of Indians. Glancing around, I could tell by their expressions that Lord John and Professor Summerlee felt as disappointed as I did.
Really, Challenger, what nonsense is this? These are just a collection of rather mediocre sketches and of no scientific use whatsoever.
Shh. Try the next page.
Huh?
What on earth? Good Lord. It's the most extraordinary creature I've ever seen.
Isn't it? Head of a fowl, body of a bloated lizard. That trailing tail. What do you think of that?
Well, it's monstrous. Grotesque.
But what made him draw such an animal?
Trade gin, I think.
And that's the best explanation you can give, is it?
Well, what's yours?
The obvious one. That the creature exists. One thing puzzles me. This tiny human figure in the foreground. Could it be evidence of a pygmy race, perhaps?
Wonderful.
Look here. You see that plant behind the animal?
Huh?
What do you think that is? A Brussels sprout? Damn it, man. It's an ivory palm. They grow to 60 feet. Don't you see? That figure was put there for a purpose. He was put there to give the scale of heights.
Good God, then the creature must be as big as Charing Cross Station.
Exactly. Now look at this. Here's an illustration from a monograph by Professor Lancaster. Probable appearance in life of the Jurassic dinosaur Stegosaurus.
Yes, yes, there certainly is a resemblance.
It might, of course, be coincidence. The American may have seen a picture of this kind and carried it in his memory. It would be likely to recur to a man in a delirium.
Well, now, look at this bone. What known creature does that belong?
I must confess that it is unfamiliar to me.
Well, you needn't be ashamed of your ignorance. I don't suppose the whole staff of the South Kensington Museum could give a name to it.
But bones can be faked quite easily, I believe.
Ah! You can take it from me that it belongs to a creature which exists upon the face of the earth, and which has not yet come under the notice of science.
Ha!
Oh, very well, I can see that you're still unconvinced. Well, now, let me continue my story. We will leave the dead American and continue. You can imagine that I could hardly come away from the Amazon without probing deeper into the matter. There were indications as to the direction from which the dead man had come, and I also found that rumors of a strange land were common among all the riverine tribes. You have no doubt heard of Kurupuri.
No, sir.
Kurupuri is the spirit of the woods. It's something evil.
Exactly. Well, all the tribes agree as to the direction where Kurupuri lives. It was the same direction from which the American had come. Eventually, I managed to persuade two of the tribesmen to become my guides. And after many adventures, which I need not describe, I came at last to that country which has never been described or indeed visited by any other man except the unfortunate Maple White, the dead American. Here, look at this photograph.
It's certainly discolored and blurred.
Yes, the unsatisfactory appearance is due to the fact that on descending the river, the boat was upset and nearly all my photographs were ruined.
How very unfortunate.
Just a moment. Those cliffs, like an enormous waterfall, aren't they the same as in the picture of the monster?
Well done. Yes, it is the same place. I found traces of the fellow's cap. Now, look at this photograph. Again, somewhat blurred, I'm afraid, Professor Summerlee. Do you see the tree-crowned pinnacle of rock there?
Yes, yes, I see it. Well, just about.
Do you observe something on that tree? Look. There.
Why, George, it looks like a large bird.
Where? Let me see. Oh, yes. Yes, I see it. It's a pelican, surely.
It is not a pelican, nor is it a bird. It may interest you to know that I succeeded in shooting that specimen, and I was able to bring it away with me.
You have it here, then?
No. It was unfortunately lost in the same boat accident which ruined my photograph.
Dear me, what a remarkable coincidence.
However, I do have part of its wing.
and this I now lay before you.
It's part of a monstrous bat.
Nothing of the sort. Here, in Lancaster's book, this picture is an excellent reproduction of the pterodactyl. On the next page is a diagram of the mechanism of its wing. Now, kindly compare that, gentlemen, with the specimen on the table before you.
Good Lord. You're right. It's exactly the same.
It would certainly appear to be similar, but...
But fiddlesticks.
But surely, Professor, with such conclusive evidence, you had only to lay all this before the proper authorities.
So in my simplicity I had imagined. But I was called a liar and a charlatan.
What happened after you shot the bird? That terror thing. Here, pass over the picture, Malone. I'd like a closer look.
Pterodactyl. Well, it was the wet season, and my stores were all but exhausted. I explored some portion of this huge cliff.
You see another trace of life?
No, but we heard some strange noises while we camped at the base of the cliff.
But what about the creature the American drew?
Well, we can only suppose he must have made his way to the summit, seen it, and drawn it later. We know, therefore, that there is a way up.
We know, Professor Challenger, precisely nothing. Here we are, asked to believe in the existence of a lost world inhabited by prehistoric monsters, purely on the basis of a few blurred photographs, unfortunately ruined in a boating accident, a piece of bat's wing, the rest of that unfortunate creature having been lost in the same boating accident, some drawings made by an American artist in a delirium, and a few supposed noises at the base of a supposed cliff in this supposed lost world.
You also have my word, sir.
Yes, we do, sir. And may I remind you that it is your word, sir, that we have come here to verify. It would seem to me that this whole thing, including your magician-like appearance among us, is merely a last-minute attempt to turn us back.
Blast your impudence, sir. And you other gentlemen, what do you think?
Well, I'm not so sure. Things seem different in London. There's many a man there who keeps his experiences to himself for fear of being disbelieved.
Ha! Malone?
I don't know. I'm so confused. The evidence seems irrefutable, and yet... Tell me, Professor, this land, these monsters, how do they come to be there?
Well, South America is a granite continent. At this single point in the interior, there has been, in some far distant age, a great sudden volcanic upheaval. These cliffs are basaltic, and therefore plutonic. An area as large, perhaps, as Sussex has been lifted en bloc with all its living contents and cut off by precipices of a hardness which defies erosion. The ordinary laws of nature have thus been suspended, and creatures have survived which would otherwise have disappeared.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
Poppycock! I still maintain that this whole elaborate subterfuge is merely an attempt to put us off at the last moment from exposing you, sir, as a humbug.
Indeed, Summerlee, it is nothing of the kind. But we leave at first light tomorrow morning for the lost world.
It was on August the 2nd that we snapped our last link with civilization when we left the steamer which had taken us upriver. Thereafter, we made our way by canoe and then overland through thick Amazonian forest. Our two learned companions contrived to bicker constantly throughout the journey, whilst Lord John and myself endeavored, unsuccessfully, to keep the peace. It was exactly 1 month to the day after leaving Manaus that Lord John and I realized that we were at last in the vicinity of the lost world.
Oh, I'm exhausted. Isn't it nearly time we rested, Lord John?
Soon, young fella, soon.
Listen, what's that?
War drums, I think. Yes, I've heard them before. They watch us every step of the way, you know.
I didn't. But how can they? In this dense forest?
Oh, they have their own ways. They talk drum talk to each other, sort of pass us along. You'd be surprised.
You hear the drums? Yeah, I'm a Mohawk Indian.
You agree, Summerly?
No doubt, sir. Like all such tribes, I should expect to find them of polysynthetic speech and of Mongolian type.
Polysynthetic, certainly. The Mongolian theory I regard with deep suspicion.
Don't they frighten you, sir, hearing the drums like that?
Not at all, young man. Besides, we shall soon be in the land of Kuripiri. They don't dare to follow us there.
As for the Mongolian theory, I should have thought that even a limited knowledge of comparative anatomy would have helped to verify it.
No doubt, sir, a limited knowledge would have that effect. However...
Look there! Look! Look! Did you see it? Did you see it through the trees? There it goes! Look! Look, Summerly! Did you see it? A pterodactyl!
Pterodactyl fiddlestick! It was a stork if ever I saw one. A pterodactyl.
Damn it, man, you must be blind as well as senile.
Say, Malone, just a minute.
What is it?
Well, now, it seems to me these two scientific johnnies are too caught up in their own arguments to take notice of any dangers. They're going to want wet-nursing, young fella. It's going to be our job to do it. Can you shoot?
About average territorial standard.
Good Lord. Bad as that.
But look here, what's all this about?
Well, Malone, I happened to have my glasses focused on that creature before it got up over the trees. Up to now, I've never really been sure whether our Professor Challenger was a madman or a liar. But now I know different.
Why? What is it?
That creature. It was no bird I've ever seen.
In the first part of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World, adapted for radio by Peggy Wells and Barry Campbell, Professor Challenger was played by Francis de Wolfe, Edward Malone by Kevin McHugh, Lord John Roxton by Gerald Harper, and Professor Summerly by Carlton Hobbs. Gladys, Carol Boyd, McArdle, Henry Stamper, Austin, Paul Gaiman, Mrs. Challenger, Norma Ronald, Policeman, Alan Dudley, Chairman, Dennis McCarthy. The episode was produced by Betty Davis.
The Lost World. Francis de Wolfe, Kevin McHugh, Gerald Harper and Carlton Hobbs in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's novel, adapted for radio by Peggy Wells and Barry Campbell. Part 2, The Edge of Terror. Extracts from the Expedition Journal of Edward Malone, reporter, London Gazette.
It was in May 1907 that our small party set out from London in search of the lost world of the Amazon. After travelling through dense forests, almost impenetrable jungle and sinister swamplands, we finally found ourselves on the very threshold of that lost world. We had come at last to the line of high red cliffs, which we had first seen in the drawings of the dead American artist, Maple White. Our problem was to scale these cliffs, and late one afternoon, camped at the base of a huge pinnacle as high as the cliffs themselves, we held a council of war. Professor Challenger, as always, presided.
I need not say that on the occasion of my last visit, I exhausted every means of climbing the cliff. And where I failed, I do not think that anyone else is likely to succeed, for I am something of a mountaineer. I had none of the appliances of a rock climber with me, but
I've taken the precaution of bringing them now. With their aid, I am positive I could climb the detached pinnacle to the summit. But so long as the main cliff overhangs, it's useless to attempt ascending that.
There seems to be only one sensible course. Let us split up into two parties, eastward and westward along the base of the cliffs, and seek for a practical point for our ascent.
I agree with Professor Somerley. The odds are this plateau is of no great size, and if we travel round it, we shall either find an easy way up or come back to the point from which we first started.
There is no easy way up, Lord John. But I admit that there is a point at which ascent is possible.
How do you know, sir?
Because, Professor Somerley, my predecessor, Maplewhite, actually made such an ascent. How otherwise could he have seen the monster which he sketched in his notebook?
There you reason somewhat ahead of the proved facts, Professor Challenger. I admit your plateau because I've seen it. But I have not as yet satisfied myself that it contains any form of life whatever.
What you admit, sir, or what you do not admit, is really of inconceivably small importance. I'm glad to perceive that the plateau itself has actually obtruded itself upon your intelligence. Now, gentlemen, I think we cannot do better than to commence our scouting expedition.
Leaving our negro servant, Zambo, to guard the camp, we set out. Challenger and Somerley, with our three Indian bearers, took the easterly direction. Lord John and myself, accompanied by Gomez and Manuel, our two half-breed guides, went towards the west, through a rocky country of tree and bamboo, and always in the shadow of those gigantic cliffs.
So, young fella.
Yes, Lord
John?
How far
do you reckon we've come now?
From the camp?
Yes.
A mile or two, perhaps.
Well, that's far enough. I think turn round, young fella. We're heading back to the camp.
Any special reason, Lord John?
The light's failing. It'll be pitch dark in half an hour, and I don't like the feel of this place.
I've been thinking the same thing myself. Only I didn't like to admit. I mean, I couldn't explain.
You don't have to explain. Look up there at those cliffs.
I am looking.
There's life up there. Bad life. Life that keeps watching us. When I think of that thing I saw flapping up out of the trees in the forest. Oh, it had a 20-foot wingspread and it had teeth like bread knives. If we... Hey, wait a minute. Where are those two half-breeds?
I don't know. I haven't seen them for the past 10 minutes.
Gomez! Manuel!
You don't think...
It's getting dark, young fella. Gomez! Manuel!
Señores! Señores!
It's all right, that's Gomez.
What's the matter?
Oh, señores! The other señor with the black beard, he has said there is a way up these cliffs. Manuel and I, we think we have found it.
What's that?
We'll show you, yes?
Show us what?
On these cliffs, I show you. We find what you call an arrow. Drawn in white chalk.
Maplewhite for a fiver.
We follow this arrow where it point. And we come to one opening in this rock of the cliff. An opening what you call
a cleft.
That's it, a cleft. One cleft where the rock open up. You follow me, yeah?
You bet your boots we follow you. Come on, Malone. You don't expect an answer, do you?
I don't know what to expect. It's only a kind of gorge cut in the rock, not very deep. Oh, John, it's blocked. A dead wall.
No, it's not. Look.
Where?
Up the side of the wall, higher. Up there. Heap of stones, loose like a ruddy staircase. And on top of that...
It looks like the mouth of a cave.
It is the mouth of a cave, and another arrow drawn on the rock. Up those stones with you now. Go on.
Steady, steady there.
Hey, mind those loose stones, young fella.
Gomez! Manuel, you come too.
Si, señores. We come.
This is the gateway to the land of monsters, laddie. Through the mouth of that cave, there's a tunnel up inside the cliffs as sure as you're born. Easy now. Here, look, let me give you a hand to the top. Go on, up you go. Nothing can stop us now, young fella. I defy anything or anybody on top of these cliffs to...
What's wrong?
Well, I hate eating my words, young fella, when I'd barely put salt on them. But look there.
You mean...
It's blocked, that's all. The roof of the ruddy cave has fallen in. We're cut off by 2 tons of rock from the only way up.
What was that?
I don't know. It sounded like...
Gomez, Manuel, did either of you laugh just now?
Laugh, senor?
Somebody laughed just then.
I don't know, senores. Maybe it was what Indian call a spirit of the woods that laughed.
Never mind the spirit of the woods. Can't we dig a way through that loose rock?
No good, young fella.
Why not?
Well, you'd only start an avalanche. It'd bury us. Don't you touch it.
And there isn't any way up.
No, I'm afraid not. Come on. It's high time we were getting back to camp.
Too much cast down to speak, we made our way back to the camp. One incident occurred, however, before we left the gorge, which is of importance in view of what came afterwards. We were at the bottom of the chasm, some 40 feet beneath the mouth of the cave, when a huge rock rolled suddenly downwards and shot past us with tremendous force. We could not see where it had come from, but Gomez and Manuel, who were still at the opening of the cave, said it had flown past them and must have fallen from above. Looking upwards, we could see no sign of movement in the green jungle which topped the cliff. There could be little doubt, however, that the stone was aimed at us. So the incident surely pointed to some form of life upon the plateau. As we moved away, our minds were full of this new development and its bearing on our plans. When we reached the camp, we found the others waiting for us.
And you're sure, Lord John, there is absolutely no chance of our clearing the fallen rocks?
None at all.
Pity. Great pity. As to the incident of the falling rock, it would merely seem to confirm my theory that some form of life does indeed exist on the plateau. The theory, which I may add, has already been proven by our own discoveries, and it seems...
Stop a minute. What did he find?
A human skeleton.
A what?
A human skeleton, lying in a patch of bamboo, with a bamboo canes growing through its smashed ribs. Almost certainly the skeleton of a white man.
I quite agree, and I don't like this.
How did the skeleton get there?
Can't you guess, Lord John?
You mean this man fell from the top of the cliff?
He fell, yes, or was thrown. This man, probably a friend or colleague of Maplewhite...
We have no evidence of that.
We have every evidence, sir. This man was running in blind terror from something which appeared to him monstrous or diabolical. He fell to his death on the sharp bamboo points, or else he was taken by human hands...
Human hands?
Taken by human hands, as I now take this skull of his from my knapsack, and dropped over the edge of that cliff. As I dropped the skull on the ground, so.
Oh, Santa Maria.
Will you now admit, Professor Samele, that there is malignant life on the plateau?
I don't know.
But does that matter now, sir?
Matter, young man?
Since we can't get to the top of the plateau.
I beg your pardon. We can get to the top of the plateau.
You mean you found a way up?
I venture to think so.
How? We can't climb the sheer face of the cliff. That's impossible.
Agreed, Lord John, agreed.
Then how in all blue blazes are you going to do it?
Will you permit me, gentlemen, to sit down on this log and address you as I might address a somewhat backward class?
All right, get on with it.
You will also, I hope, spare me your congratulations. My natural modesty forbids any such display. The inspiration, if I may term it so, came to me only 10 minutes ago. I was thinking, oddly enough, of a paper read to the Edinburgh Zoological Society by a certain Dr. Illingworth.
One moment, Professor Challenger.
You spoke, Professor Summary?
Were you by any chance referring to Dr. Angus Illingworth of Edinburgh?
I was, sir. Is he a friend of yours?
That charlatan, that insufferable mountebank, a friend of mine?
You agree, perhaps, that Dr. Illingworth has no sense?
I agree with the utmost emphasis.
His views on the Weald and Slates are entire puerility.
His insulting review of my last book occupied 7.5 pages of the Zoological Quarterly.
Professor Summerlee, shake hands.
Professor Challenger, it's a pleasure.
Young fellow, my lad, listen.
Master John.
We've got it. The password, Dr. Illingworth of Edinburgh. Whenever these two start spitting in each other's eye, just mention Dr. Illingworth of Edinburgh. Got it?
Got it, Lord John.
You were telling us, Professor Challenger, how we could get to the top of the plateau. Now, if we put the same question to Dr. Illingworth of Edinburgh...
Dr. Illingworth, the great zoologist...
He could probably tell us straight away.
Tell us like a shot.
And do you intimate, sir, that I can't? Look around you.
Well?
What do you see?
Well, it's your campfire, load of provisions, line of red cliffs.
Nothing else, my friend?
Well, nothing that'll help us, no.
You don't see, for instance, the pinnacle of rock there. The pinnacle of rock that rises as high as the plateau and has a huge tree on top of it.
Well, that won't help us.
You think not, Lord John?
We've got rock climbing gear, yeah. We could get to the top of the pinnacle, yes. But even if we got there, we'd still be 40 feet from the edge of the plateau.
We can never get across.
We can at least all reach the summit. When we are up, I may be able to show you that the resources of my brain are by no means exhausted.
It was towards noon the next day, a brilliant, burning day, that the last of us managed to crawl up on top of that pinnacle, a grassy space some 25 feet square. It was a hair-raising climb, to say the least. But now, at last, we were able to gaze across at that curious plateau. There it lay, the lost world, across the 40-foot gulf, green and silent, its trees glistening in the sun where it stretched away from us, deep and sinister as a new continent.
This is indeed curious. Very interesting. Very interesting indeed.
What, Professor Summerlee?
This tree, Mr. Malone. You will please note the smooth bark and the small ribbed leaves. Tell me, are they not familiar to you?
Why, it's a beech.
Exactly, a beech tree. A fellow countryman in a far land.
Not only a fellow countryman, my good sir, but also, if I may be allowed to enlarge your simile, an ally of the first value. This beech tree will be our savior.
George, a bridge.
Exactly, my friend, a bridge. Where willpower and intellect go together, there's always a way out. A drawbridge had to be found, which could be dropped across the abyss. Behold it! There is our bridge, gentlemen, to the lost world!
Brilliant, sir. The tree's a good way. 60 feet high. If it only falls the right way, it'll easily cross the chasm.
Mr. Malone.
Yes, sir?
You, my young friend, have the thews and sinews. I think you will be the most useful at this task.
I can hardly wait to begin, sir.
One moment, Mr. Malone. I must beg that you will kindly refrain from thinking for yourself. You will do exactly as you are told. Now, I suggest that you make your first incision here. Really, Mr. Malone, can't you go any faster?
Easy now, the lad's doing his best.
Oh, but this, sir, is a mere tree.
It is a tree 60 feet high. It's got to fall exactly across the gulf with its edge on the other side.
I have a presentiment, sir, that it won't...
Won't what?
Won't fall as we wish it.
Oh.
If it rolls over the edge and leaves us still without a bridge...
You know, Professor Sumler, you're the cheeriest little ray of sunshine I ever did see.
I state an obvious possibility, Lord Char.
I tell you, man, it can't.
Indeed, sir. And why not?
Professor Challenger's calculations.
I'm deeply suspicious of any calculations made by Professor Challenger on any subject.
Indeed, sir.
I repeat it, sir. And suppose the tree does fall as we wish it, how are we to get across?
Let us try the trunk of the tree and hop across.
Over a 1,000-foot gulf underneath.
Dash it, man, there's no other way.
Even on this big grass plot, I have an unsteady feeling in the legs, as though something were urging me onto the edge. I confess it without shame.
Stand
and to
back.
Cross that gulf on
She's
a tree
going.
Trunk.
Holy glory, hallelujah!
Got it!
Stop dead on the edge, Professor Challenger. Shake hands.
Well, it seems to me there's a lot of indiscriminate handshaking going on, but by George, here's my hand too.
I remove my hat, gentlemen, and I thank you deeply for this not unmerited tribute. The resources of a great brain, if I may modestly say so, are equal to any small obstacle. There is the bridge. There is the last word. I shall now, with your permission, be the first to cross the bridge.
Half a minute, old chap. I can't allow that.
Do my ears deceive me, Lord John? You can't allow it.
Listen, old chap. Look over at those bushes.
Well, sir?
We're invading enemy territory, don't you see? It may be all right over there.
Oh, of course it's all
right. But there may be a tribe of cannibals waiting for lunchtime. We haven't got rifles, we haven't got anything.
Then what do you suggest?
Malone and I'll climb down again, fetch up the rifles.
Oh, this delay is intolerable.
I know, old chap, but better learn wisdom before you get served up as veal stew. Oh, speaking of that, we'll also fetch up Manua Gomez with provisions. Then you can cross the bridge while we cover you with the rifles.
This is good sense, Professor Challenger.
I am not aware, sir, that I need to be instructed in good sense by you or anyone else. But I do agree that a certain elementary caution... Oh, very well, go and get the rifles, but hurry, hurry!
Ready now, everybody?
Quite ready, Lord John.
As for me, Lord John, I await your lordship's gracious permission to cross the tree bridge. Had I been aware that your lordship's permission was necessary at the beginning of this adventure...
All right, old chap, don't get your temper up. No. Gomez!
Yes, senor.
You and Manuel stay here when the rest of us go over. We may need to give you some instructions.
True, senor. You may need to give instructions, yes.
Ready with the rifles, everybody else? All right, Professor Challenger, you first.
Sit down carefully, sir. Don't lose your grip.
I have no intention, young man, of losing my grip, either mentally or physically. The position, I confess, is a trifle undignified. It is not suited...
Easy now.
It is not suited to the historical painting, which will no doubt one day be made of this momentous occasion.
You next, Professor Summerlee.
I'm quite ready, gentlemen. If you'll sling two of those rifles round my neck.
What's wrong, Professor Summerlee?
Has it occurred to you?
Well, what?
Has it occurred to you that our friend Challenger, as he hops across there, looks exactly like a gigantic bullfrog?
One moment, sir. Did you by any chance say what I thought you said?
Don't stop, Professor Challenger. For God's sake, don't turn round.
Did you say bullfrog, sir? Were my ears assailed by any mention of a bull?
Go on, sir. Go on to the other side.
I'm sorry, Professor Challenger, if the harmless joke offends you. Now, if you'll continue over to the other side, I shall follow you along the tree... like this.
Easy now. Both of you.
Look here, Lord John, you don't think they're going to sit out on that tree and begin sloshing at each other 1,000 feet above ground?
I can't say. They're crazy enough for anything.
It's all right. Challenger's over. Any sign of life in those bushes?
I can't see any. Done it. Somebody's over. All right, now you're next, my lad. Go on, over you go.
I don't like this a little bit. But if those two professors can go over and never turn a hair...
Now get careful. Get a good grip on the tree. That's right. And don't look down. It's looking down that gives you the vertigo.
I've got vertigo already, thanks.
Now, don't look down, I keep telling you. Oof. Don't look out.
I'm all right, Lord John. Nearly slipped.
Phew. Now follow your own advice, young fella. Don't look round. What's the matter?
I'm just wondering, Lord John, what you think you're doing.
Me, young fella?
Yes, you.
Oh, I'm walking across, young fella, like this. It's so much simpler, don't you think?
And that was how, as the sun began to sink across the jungle, we first set foot on the lost world. No sign of life in all that green stillness. Not even the cawing of a bird. The last thing we saw as we looked back was Gomez standing motionless on the rock pinnacle, smiling at us. Ahead was a bolt of dense scrub, and we shouted congratulations to each other as we hurried forward. It was the last time we did congratulate ourselves on that evil day. Because when we had got no more than 12 feet into the scrub, and I was nearest the edge of the cliff...
What was that?
I hesitate to pronounce an opinion, sir, when I can't see...
Professor Challenger! Lord John! Professor Summerlee!
Yes, what is it?
Come here! Come back here!
What is it? What's wrong?
The bridge has gone.
The bridge has gone?
Look for yourselves. The tree slipped off the edge of the cliffs. It smashed to pieces 1,000 feet below...
Listen!
Sworn I'd heard that laugh before.
You did hear it. It's the same laughing we heard in the gorge last night.
Lord John Roxton! Lord John Roxton!
That sounded like Gomez.
It is Gomez, senores. It is your faithful Gomez.
Where the devil is he?
I am on the other side of these, what you call, pinnacles, senores, where you can't see me and you can't shoot me. Who led you to this place? Manuel Alai,
Who pushed the tree over the edge? Man, where are I?
Challenger, just talk to the fellow, will you? Hold him there. I'm going to slip along the edge of the cliff where I can get a side shot at him with my rifle.
Oh, John, wait.
Let him go, young man. Let vengeance go its course. I ask you the meaning of this, Gomez.
Ask a Lord John Roxton. Ask him if he remembers shooting Lopez of the Putumayo River. I am the brother of Lopez, senores. Flail of the slave traders is Lord John Roxton. Flail of Lord John Roxton am I.
Professor Challenger, I can see Roxton now.
I say this last to you, and then I go away. You will die up there, senores. Cut off from the world. You will die up there because Lord John Roxton has shot my brother. And now at last I... Ah!
Lord John Roxton, they say, is a dead shot.
Yes.
Where's Manuel? He was with Gomez. Something tells me, with peculiar clearness, gentlemen, that we shall not be troubled with either of them any longer.
Excellent, Professor Challenger. Very good indeed. And doesn't it tell you anything else?
Anything else?
You've brought us to the ends of the earth, sir.
You gratify me, Professor Summers.
Your ingenuity has shown us a way to a land of monsters. But with that bridge gone, can your ingenuity show us any way down? By the Lord's mercy, sir, you've really done it this time. We're marooned!
For a moment, we stood staring at each other in bewilderment. Marooned in a mysterious land in which lay unknown terrors. Marooned without supplies or without any hope of contacting the outside world. In our first brief panic, however, we had forgotten the Negro Zambo. And it was his voice calling across that 40-foot gap which restored us to our senses.
Master! Master! Can you hear me, sir? Master!
Zambo! Zambo! You hear me?
Yes, Master! I hear!
You perceive, I hope, that we are in a somewhat precarious position.
Now, look here, old chap. He won't understand that highfalutin talk.
Look, am I the leader of this expedition, or am I not?
All right, but speak so he can get the hang of what you're saying.
I shall make myself perfectly clear. Zambo!
Yes, Master!
You observe, no doubt, the critical nature of our situation.
Yes, Master. Maybe ghost get you.
What ghost?
Oh, be quiet, Professor Somebody.
You have the rope there, Zambo.
Rope no good, Master. Too thin to make bridge across.
I know that, my good Zambo.
Well, then what's the game? Would you tell us?
Throw one end of the rope across to us. Then tie the other round as many boxes of provisions and ammunition as you can bring up. We'll drag them over to this side. Don't forget to include a camera.
Did you say a camera, Professor Challenger?
Yes, Professor Summerlee, I said a camera. I want photographic evidence if something should attack us.
Attack us?
If, in short, a flesh-eating dinosaur should step out of these bushes now.
Zambo, don't forget the elephant gun cartridges, will you?
No, Chief. I not forget.
And you won't leave your post?
No, Chief. I not leave. But no evil keep Indian.
Why not?
Too much afraid ghost. You be careful.
That thought was in our minds when we slept for our first night on the lost world. We supped and camped at the very edge of the cliff among some bushes. These bushes turned out, however, to be infested with enormous blood ticks, as I found out to my cost in the morning.
Most interesting, Mr. Malone. That blood tick on your leg, which you have so unfortunately crushed.
Good Lord, Professor Summerly, did you think I was going to let that vile thing stay where it was? Look at all the blood which squirted out when I picked it off and burst it. My blood, sir. Mine.
Steady on, young fellow, my lad. It's rotten luck we settled on this spot. Might have known there'd be some pretty diabolical insect life in these bushes.
Well, Mr. Malone should be proud to be chosen. We cannot do less than call this first fruit of our labours Ixodes Maloni. Very small inconvenience of being bitten, my young friend, Cannot, I'm sure, weigh with you as against the glorious privilege of having your name inscribed in the deathless roll of zoology. Unhappily, you have crushed this fine specimen.
Fine specimen? Filthy vermin, you mean?
You should cultivate the scientific eye and the detached mind, Mr. Malone. To a man of philosophic temperament like myself, the blood tick, with its lancet-like proboscis and its distending stomach, is as beautiful a work of nature as the peacock or the aurora borealis. It pains me to hear you speak of it in so unappreciative a fashion. No doubt, with due diligence, we can secure some other specimen.
There can be no doubt of that, Professor Challenger. One has just disappeared behind your shirt collar.
What? Oh, dang!
The bushes were full of the horrible pests, and it was clear that we must shift our camp. We moved to a small clearing, thickly surrounded by trees on all sides. There were some flat slabs of rock in the center with a spring of water close by. Here, we made our first plans for the invasion of this new country, surrounded by our ammunition and enough provisions to last for several weeks. This was to be our headquarters, our place of refuge against sudden danger and the guardhouse for our stores. Fort Challenger, we called it. The others slept that night, round a dying campfire that threw gleams among the great trees round about. But I can't say I slept much. It was towards morning, in the hour of suicides and bad dreams, that suddenly...
Good Lord! Look out! Get away, you swine!
What is this? Somebody call out.
Easy, young fellow, my lad. Now, what's wrong?
I don't want you to think I'm out of my mind, but I saw something.
Professor Summerlee, will you perk up that fire? Now, you saw what?
A white face. A human face.
All right. Now, where did you see it?
In that big tree, there. With the branches like ferns. The branches parted and the face looked down. It was flat and white, and it had a body like a reddish pig.
You were dreaming, young fella.
I wasn't dreaming, I tell you.
But a human face?
A human face or an ape's. That's it. An ape's. Only without any hair. And with curved teeth.
The anthropoid ape, young man, is unknown in South America. Are you quite sure of this?
Absolutely sure.
Had this creature a tail?
No.
Did you notice whether it could cross its thumb over its palm?
Hang it all, sir. I only got a brief glimpse. Then I threw a stone and it swung away.
Well, that was very hasty of you, my boy. Very hasty and injudicious. Had you been able to coax it down
coax
here...
Coax it down?
That's what I said.
It was the evilest looking brute I ever saw in my life. You didn't want me to invite the damn thing to breakfast.
In the interests of science, young man...
As a scientist myself, sir, I agree with Malone.
You agree with Malone, sir?
I agree with Malone, sir. Have you forgotten the skeleton?
What skeleton?
The skeleton of the man thrown from these cliffs and impaled on the bamboo points 1,000 feet below.
Listen.
Was that the sound it made?
Yes.
If there are any more of these brutes hanging about watching us...
Yeah, but they probably are.
Then we've got to walk softly and look sharp.
As soon as it's daylight, we begin our exploration.
In which direction?
Following the course of the stream, naturally. That will always lead us back to camp. We can surround our stores with thorn hedges. Then, when we penetrate into that forest in full daylight...
Very little forest, I should say. Swamp, swamp, and nothing but swamp. Shall we turn back?
Turn back? Why?
I see no plant life of interest to the botanist. Only the swamp and our own footprints.
Stop a bit.
Well, Lord John?
Not only our own footprints. Look at that.
What in the name?
Now do you believe, Professor Summerlee? Now is your small conceit broken.
What in the name of sense is it?
A three-toed footprint.
Well, I see that, confounded, but the thing must be 4 times the size of an elephant. What sort of a bird leaves a track like that?
Not a bird, Lord John. A reptile.
A reptile with...
To be exact, a dinosaur. And you, Professor Summerlee, do you call me a liar now in face of these tracks?
I must confess, Professor Challenger, I really must confess.
Surely... These tracks are Wealdon.
Wealdon, exactly. Meaning what?
This is a creature walking erect on 3-toed feet, and occasionally putting one of its five-fingered forepaws to the ground. Now, if we were to see one of these animals...
We're going to see one, old chap.
How so?
Because I swear these tracks are fresh.
Shh! Creep forward, all of you. Look through this screen of brushwood. Is it? Yes, my friend. The denizens of the Lost World.
There were five of them, like a nightmare in daylight. Scaled like lizards, with witless rolling eyes that seemed to look at us through the brush. They sat up on their haunches in that lade and browsed on tree branches as a rabbit browses on lettuce. Stare of their eyes shocked you. It was like the dragon you dreamed about as a child. Their forepaws struck and slashed at the tree branches. When one fell down on its feet, you could feel the thud as the ground shook.
Quiet, everybody, quiet!
Oh, am I seeing things?
Do you question, sir, the evidence of your own eyes? One moment, don't fire.
Why not?
In the first place, the sound of a shot might alarm the whole countryside.
I know that, but if I could get one head, look, just one head to take home with me.
The whole sporting world would turn green. What about the newspaper readers?
Look here, Professor, if I just drilled the nearest one and looked straight through the eye...
You still wouldn't hurt him.
Well, not even with this gun?
Not even with that gun. Have you got the camera, Mr. Muller?
Yes, but I can't even get the blighters into the viewfinder. They're too big.
Keep down. They'll see us.
And you, Professor Summoney... I can scarcely wonder that your eyes bulge and that your mockery of a pure intelligence returns to haunt you. What do you say?
Professor Challenger, I apologize.
Professor Summoney, your apology is accepted.
Oh, wait a minute, you two. Look, don't stand up, not to shake hands with the brutes right on top of us.
Look out!
That one came down with all his paws at once. If he'd come down on us, would he, Fan?
Like an elephant. Walking on a grape, yes.
But they seem harmless, no?
My dear sir, they are harmless. The iguanodon.
The what?
The iguanodon, Lord John. You'll find his prehistoric footprints all over the sands in Kent and Sussex.
He's charming and childlike, like our friend Malone. He's all brawn and no brain. Observe the nearest one.
Well, not too close, thanks.
See, there. He reaches after a bunch of foliage too high in the tree. He can't reach it. So he uproots the whole tree. When the tree crashes over on top of them, the whole tribe take fright and run. A brief thunder of their passing, a gleam of slaty scales, and the glade is empty.
What will they say to this in England?
Oh, my dear Samuel, I can tell you with great confidence exactly what they will say. They'll say that you are an infernal liar, just as you said a minute.
Why, in the face of photographs?
Oh, faked, Summerlee. Clumsily faked.
In the face of specimens.
Ah, there we may have them. Malone and his filthy Fleet Street crew may be all yelping our praises yet. The day we saw five live iguanodons in a glade of maple whiteland. Put it down in your journal, my young friend, and send it to your rag.
And we're ready to get the toe end of the editorial boot in return. Things look a bit different from the latitude of London, young fella. All this will seem a bit of a dream to ourselves in a month or two. I can't see us being able to lead an iguanodon back, show it off in Hyde Park.
You're quite right, Lord John. There's hardly any likelihood we shall get back ourselves. In the meantime, there's nowhere to go but forward.
We may have travelled a mile or more, keeping to the bank of the stream. A belt of brushwood led up to a tangle of rocks at the top of that boulder-strewn slope. Grey and eerie the place looked, with its graveyard rocks. Lord John was well ahead, scouting. We saw him get to the top of that slope. Then we saw him drop down suddenly as though he'd been shot, and peer over the edge.
What is it, Professor Challenger?
I don't know. He's signalling us to stop.
Listen.
Well?
Perhaps it was my imagination, but I could have sworn I heard a kind of...
Kind of what?
Well, it doesn't matter now. Lord John is coming back.
Lord John? Is any...
Shh.
Keep quiet.
Is anything wrong?
Well, listen, all of you. You want to see something, you'll raise your hair. Just crawl up and look over the edge of those rocks. Crouch down and don't make a noise.
What is it?
Forward now. That's it. Keep low.
What is it? I insist on knowing.
Do you hear anything, Lord John? All of you must hear it now.
I hear something.
You hear the Devil's Nursery, old chap.
Devil's Nursery?
It's a volcanic pit, like a big bowl in the rocks, with green scummy water at the bottom. And in that pit...
Well?
Pterodactyls. Thousands of them.
Pterodactyls?
Well, don't you remember that flapping thing with wings 20 feet long? I saw it over the trees the other day.
I do indeed remember the pterodactyl. Professor Summerlee said it was a stork.
I said so.
Do you deny you said it was a stork?
Keep quiet, for God's sake.
Remember Dr. Illingworth of Edinburgh.
By George, neither Dr. Illingworth nor anybody else ever saw a sight like this. Crouch down and look over the edge.
The place was a breeding ground of pterodactyls. On rocks and in water seethed hundreds of specimens like medieval devils. Hideous mothers brooded over their leathery, yellowish eggs and watched their young in the water. Round the higher rocks sat the horrible males. They sat absolutely motionless, except for the rolling of their red eyes or a snap of their rat-trap beaks as a dragonfly went past.
Professor Challenger, I ask your pardon again. This is worth risking everything to see.
Refreshing, is it not?
Very refreshing. The flood of light it throws on the habits of the pterodactyl.
Shh, keep down, you two.
Observe the dead fish and birds among the rocks. This proves...
gregarious, my dear sir, like penguins.
Not a doubt of it.
If we could perhaps have a closer view of the eggs.
Why not?
I'll tell you why not.
Aren't you interested, Lord John?
Interested, yes. I'm interested in the soil around the edge of that water. Blue volcanic clay, ain't it?
I believe so. Why?
Well, never mind, but if you want to start something you can't finish, just stick your head up and say pretty, pretty to a nest of pterodactyls.
There is, of course, a certain amount of danger. A
certain amount? They'll come diving down on us with teeth like bread knives.
What with the care I take, Lord John?
Oh, no, old chap.
No. I rather pride myself on my ability to stalk unseen as quietly as a shadow. I can put my hand on this loose boulder, for instance, and rest my weight on it without once disturbing...
Look out!
It occurs to me, Professor
Those
Challenger.
Brutes are spreading their wings. They're going up.
It occurs to me, Professor Challenger, we'd better run for it.
Run for it, sir?
Science or no science, yes.
Make for the wood and keep together. They will get among the trees.
Mr. Malone.
Yes,
sir? Have you got the camera?
Certainly, but...
Photograph it. I implore you to photograph that fine specimen coming down for us now.
He's diving at a mile a minute. Doc! Now, come on, make for the trees, all of you. If anybody talks science, I'll brain him. Now run!
We staggered through the brushwood, and even as we reached the trees, the harpies were on us again. Summerlee was knocked down. We tore him up and rushed among the trunks. Once there, we were safe, for those huge wings had no space for their sweep beneath the branches. As we limped homewards, sadly mauled, we saw them for a long time flying at a great height against the blue sky, soaring round and round, no bigger than wood pigeons, their eyes no doubt still following us. At last, as we reached the thicker woods, they gave up the chase and we saw them no more. We halted beside a brook to bathe our wounds.
Well, a most interesting and convincing experience, gentlemen. We are exceptionally well informed, Summerlee, as to the habits of the enraged pterodactyl.
Yes, indeed.
It's worth noting that our young friend has received an undoubted stab, while Lord John's coat could only have been torn by a bite. Professor Summerlee has a nasty cut on his forehead, and I myself have been beaten about the head by their wings. Yes, we have indeed had a remarkable exhibition of the pterodactyl's various methods of offence.
Well, it was touch and go for our lives.
and I can't think of a more rotten sort of death than to be oosted by such filthy vermin. I'm sorry to fire my rifle, but by Jove, there was no great choice.
We should not be here if you hadn't, Lord John.
May do no harm. Among those woods there must be many loud cracks from falling trees, which may sound like a gun. Now, I think we'd had enough thrills for one day. The quicker we get back to camp and the surgical box, the better. We don't know what venom may have been in those hideous jaws.
I must confess, gentlemen, I'm rather glad to see our camp again.
Just a minute. Somebody's been here.
How do you mean?
The thorn hedge has been disturbed. Somebody's handled the tins of provisions. Spilled a box of cartridges.
Somebody? You mean apes?
I don't know.
Is anything else going to happen?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. When it gets dark, all sorts of things could be looking at us from those trees. We better get a fire going at once.
Oh, this, sir, is mere superstition.
You think so?
What we need, sir, is food. The minds and spirits of all men, even including myself, are depressed by long exertion without sustenance. Good meal, a night's sleep, and tomorrow morning...
One moment.
Yes, Professor Summerlee?
May I suggest, sir, that we sit down and call a conference here and now?
A conference?
Yes, for some plan of immediate strategy.
Oh, by all means, if you insist.
You agree, Lord John?
Blue volcanic clay.
What's that?
Sorry, old chap. How's wool gathering? Yeah, go ahead.
Several references, I believe, have been made to Professor Challenger's giant brain.
Come down, no. Modesty forbids.
Very well. I suggest he employed this giant brain on some scheme for getting us off this plateau. He got us here. Now let him get us away.
And our exploration of the plateau?
That must stop, sir. Here and now.
Are you mad, sir?
No, sir. We came here, if you remember, with a perfectly definite purpose, to find out whether or not you were telling the truth.
And you did find out?
Yes, I admit it.
Thank you.
That mission is now fulfilled. We can't explore the plateau, and you know it. It'll require a large expedition and special equipment.
You know, Challenger, there is truth in that.
The plateau is huge. It's thickly wooded with immense trees. Why, we could blunder here for weeks and still have no notion of the geography.
Thickly wooded with huge trees. Geography? By George!
What's wrong with you, young fella?
Huge trees, I've got it.
Got what?
Look at that tree there. The one where I saw the ape last night. It must be 100 feet high.
Well?
If I climbed up there tomorrow morning with a notebook and pencil...
You could see out over the whole plateau.
And draw a map of everything. Then we'd have real data, the whole geography, for an exploring party later.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all.
Worthy, if I may say so, of a more enlightened intelligence has ever been shown by a journalist in all the history of your repulsive tribe. Will this satisfy you, Professor Summerlee?
If you agree to stop exploring, yes.
Then there is nothing, I think, that to trouble us further.
I wonder.
When I devote the powers of my own intellect to our descent from the plateau, the problem is as good as solved. In the meantime, we take our ease by a good campfire with a starless night outside. There's nothing to menace us now, nothing to trouble our slumbers in all the vast peace and quiet.
Listen, wait.
Summerlee. What on earth was that?
Nothing to trouble our slumbers.
Vast peace and quiet.
Malone, throw some wood on the fire.
Right. Got your rifle.
That row wasn't very far away from here. No further away, I'll swear, than the glade where we saw those...
Iguanodons?
Yeah, that's it. And you're the oracle, Professor Challenger. Now, what's going on out there?
A forest tragedy, Lord John. I spoke too soon.
Forest tragedy?
I warned you, gentlemen. We might meet carnivorous monsters. Beasts of prey that could feed on lions and tigers as a cat feeds on mice.
Then you think...
The big, blundering iguanodon, small-brained and harmless, has been attacked by something that tore it in pieces as easily as you might rip up a sofa cushion.
Something bigger?
No, something smaller, but infinitely more deadly.
Well, I don't know what that bounder is. I'm past guessing anything by this time, but I only hope it's afraid of fire.
Why so?
Because it's heading towards this camp now.
How'd you know that?
You don't live in the bush without being able to smell trouble. And listen. You hear that?
Yes.
To judge by the sound, Professor Challenger.
Yes, Professor Summerlee?
I should say an Allosaurus.
Or a Megalosaurus.
Exactly. We speak with insufficient data and without actual sight of the creature.
Look here, Lord John, there's a big gap in our torn hedge. Do you think it can...
Get through?
Yes.
I don't know.
Keep your rifle ready, young fella, and hand me a blazing stick out of the fire.
What are you going to do?
You'll see. But something's got to be done, and done in a hurry. It's outside the thorn hedge. Now.
In the second part of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World, adapted for radio by Peggy Wells and Barry Campbell, Professor Challenger was played by Francis DeWolf, Edward Malone by Kevin McHugh, Lord John Roxton by Gerald Harper, and Professor Summerlee by Carlton Hobbs. Gomez, Trader Faulkner. Zambo, Tommy Eitel. Special effects were by the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and other effects were by Janet Mitchell and Lloyd Silverthorne. Technical assistance was by Patience Pratt, and the episode was produced by Betty Davis. The Lost World. Francis DeWolf, Kevin McHugh, Gerald Harper, and Carlton Hobbs in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's novel, adapted for radio by Peggy Wells and Barry Campbell. Part 3, Our Eyes Have Seen Great Wonders. Extracts from the expedition journal of Edward Malone, reporter, London Gazette. 1907.
Black night on the lost world. Around a campfire, surrounded by a thin hedge of thorns, my three companions and I stood petrified, clutching our rifles tightly. Outside our flimsy barrier, something huge, something formless, something out of black prehistoric night, was approaching, breathing almost at the gap in the thorns, making the hedge quiver as it brushed past.
Malone.
Yes, Lord John.
Hand me a blazing branch out of that fire.
What are you going to do?
You'll see.
A most curious breeding, Professor Challenger. Where he's found the gap in the hedge.
Surely a well-placed rifle shot, Roxton.
No.
Why not? If it gets over the hedge, we're done.
And if we only wound the brute, Professor Summerlee, we're double done. The branch, young fella.
Find the sparks. We don't want to set the hedge on fire.
Now, take hold of the thorns on each side of the gap. Tear it. Make it wider.
Make it wider?
Yes, I'm going out.
Don't be a blasted fool. Don't.
Picture to yourself a monstrous shape standing 15 feet in height from its clawed pads to the crest of its squat, toad-like head. Imagine a face alike to some nightmarish gargoyle, warty and leprous, the mouth daubed with fresh blood, looming above the light of the flames as Lord John held up the blazing branch.
Roxton, for God's sake, Roxton, come back!
We saw the toad face burn as he flung the fire straight at it. The scream of that beast brought out the sweat on my body. Then, as it crashed away in the undergrowth, silence fell again.
That's done it. Oh, bit of a near thing, though.
Bit of a near thing?
Yes, I thought he wouldn't face the fire.
As leader of this expedition, I say you should not have taken such a risk.
There was nothing else to be done, old chap. If he got in here among us, did you see those teeth?
I did, I assure you.
However, Lord John, I thank you. We can only hope, despite the very bad light and the slowness of photographic film, that this camera will record some...
Wait a minute.
Is anything wrong?
You mean to say you were sitting here trying to photograph the brute?
The scientific mind, sir, is always alert.
Oh, my.
This creature which attacked us, this Allosaurus...
Or Megalosaurus.
Thank you. This Allosaurus, or Megalosaurus, was somewhat repulsive to look at, reminding me forcibly of one or two of my colleagues in the scientific world. But science required a record of it. You agree, Professor Summerly?
I agree, sir, that we must get off this plateau as quickly as we can. What we ought to be doing today, tomorrow, and all the time is finding some way out of the trap into which we've fallen. You're all turning your brains towards getting into the country. I say we should be scheming how to get out of it.
I am surprised, sir, that any man of science should commit himself to so ignoble a sentiment. You suggest leaving this land before we've acquired more than the most superficial knowledge of it, or its content.
You must remember that I have a large class in London who are at present at the mercy of an extremely inefficient locum tenens.
I must say, I think it'd be a mighty poor thing to go back to London for. I know a great deal more of this place than I do at present.
I could never face old McCardle, my editor. Still, it's not really worth discussing. We can't get down, even if we want to.
As our young friend observes, we cannot get down in any case. So it's a waste of energy to discuss it.
It's a waste of energy to do anything else. Let me remind you that we came here upon a perfectly definite mission to test the truth of Professor Challenger's statements. Those statements we are now in a position to endorse. Our ostensible work is therefore done. Professor Challenger has devised means for getting us onto this plateau when it appeared to be inaccessible. I think we should now call upon him to use the same ingenuity in getting us back to the world from which we came.
The problem of the descent is, at first sight, a formidable one, yet I cannot doubt that the intellect can solve it. I am prepared to agree with Professor Summerly that a protracted stay in Maple White Land is, at present, inadvisable. At the same time, I refuse to leave until we have made at least a superficial examination of this country and are able to take back with us something in the nature of a chart.
The one intelligent suggestion has come from Malone here. Tomorrow, he must climb the biggest tree and make a map of the plateau. Then our work is done.
Look here, young fellow. Can you do it?
Do what?
Swarm up that tree without breaking your neck. It's tricky work. Why, it must be 80 foot high.
I'll do it, Lord John, if I do break my neck. This is the first time I've contributed anything to this show.
Not at all, my boy, not at all.
And I used to be pretty good at trees when I was a boy in Ireland.
Yeah. What about apes, though?
Apes, sir?
Well, Malone saw a nasty-looking ape-human in that tree. What if it's got friends?
I'll risk that. Just give me a chance to prove I'm good for something. Tomorrow, when there's a good light and I can get a grip on that tree, I'll go up, high up, to the topmost branches.
Malone! I say, Malone! Can you hear me?
My dear sir, he can't hear you. He's too far up among the foliage.
But he's been gone in that tree for hours. If anything's happened up there...
If anything had happened, Lord John...
Well?
The law of gravity would have returned him in short order. Rest easy.
Hello,
oh, listen. I thought I heard...
Hello, down there!
Malone! Are you all right?
Perfectly all right. Just a bit windy.
Did you find
out? Half a tick. Give the lad a chance to get down.
Stand clear. I'm going to swing from the lowest branch and drop.
You all right, young fella?
Fine, thanks.
Well, sir, and what did you see?
I've been clear to the top. I could see for miles. I've got a sketch of the whole country here in this notebook. And I can tell you what's in the middle of the plateau.
Yes, what is in the middle?
A lake.
A lake, eh?
A big lake with red cliffs on the other side. And, I think, caves in the cliffs. What's more, I swear the caves are inhabited.
Or by these ape things, you mean?
No, by human beings. Like Indians. This is the biggest thing yet. Can't we set off now and explore it?
My dear young man.
Can't we?
You must learn, Mr. Malone, to curb your natural impatience. I myself am never impatient, and I find it helps me in life. Much too late to go exploring. Well, I must say, Mr. Malone, that you have done very well.
By George, he has.
This lake in the middle, what shall we call it? It's up to you to name the lake, my young friend. You saw it first. If you want to call it Lake Malone...
Not Lake Malone, no, but...
Mm-hmm. But what?
I want to call it Lake Gladys.
Lake Gladys?
Yes. Why not?
Oh, this is most unscientific. It wouldn't look well on a map.
Who in blazes cares how it looks on a map? If Malone wants to name it after his girl, why not?
Professor Summerlee, I think, has never been young.
Right?
Ah, gentlemen, the season of youth. How much I sympathize. How well I remember. I myself, I fear, was well known in my youth as something of a Don Juan.
You, sir?
I, sir. And why not?
It seems to me improbable, sir, that any young lady not totally blind could view your countenance without the gravest perturbation.
Lord John!
Yes, young fellow?
Don't you think that Dr. Illingworth of Edinburgh is a man of very distinguished appearance?
Yes, I do, as it happens.
That's got him. Go on, pile it on. All the same, Challenger's right, you know, about one thing. We can't go exploring that lake until tomorrow.
But I could. And like a fool, I did. The full moon was shining brightly that night, and the rest of them were asleep when the great idea came to me. Suppose I crept out of the camp now and explored the central lake and came back at breakfast time with a full account of it. And out I slipped, while Summerlee, the most futile of sentinels, dozed by the fire. It was a fearsome walk. How can I convey the utter silence, the loneliness, the emptiness of that forest moonlight? Emptiness, and yet shadows seemed to prowl on padded feet. It might have been 2:30 in the morning when I saw a gleam of water through the jungle. There was the lake. But it was not at the lake that I stared in amazement. It was at the cliffs beyond, where I had seen the caves that afternoon. Now I could see tiny disks of light along those caves. Fires. Fires lighted by the hand of man. This was proof to take back on my homeward journey. I was more than halfway back, emerging from the dreadfulness of the forest when... What's that? No movement of the shadows or moonlight. But 1/2 mile more along that road and... Then it flashed across me that the beast, whatever it was, must surely be after me. I remembered again the blood-slobbered face we had seen in the light of Lord John's torch. Then I saw it. The movement of the bushes when it hopped out into clear moonlight, hopping like a monstrous moving shadow. I turned to run. But to my horror, I found I could not move. Sheer terror held me frozen to the spot. A rifle shot. Something was happening to my companions back at the camp. I must help them. Then I began to run. Up to then, the beast had hunted by scent, and his movement was slow. But now, he had seen me. Now, as he came round the curve in the path, he was gaining on me in great bounds. The moonlight shone on his huge projecting eyes, on the row of enormous teeth in his open mouth, on the gleaming claws of his forearms. His thick,
gasping breathing seemed louder and louder. I could hear the thud, thud, thud as he overtook me. Then he was beside me. Every instant I expected to feel his grip on my back. Then I felt myself falling. Falling.
When I came to my senses, I found myself at the bottom of an evil-smelling pit. By the clear light of the moon, I was able to see the great, blood-stained, sharpened stake pointing towards the sky, and I realized that the pit was a trap, dug by man, in order to trap monsters, and that stumbling into the pit had saved my life. Then I remembered the rifle shots I had heard, and scrambling hurriedly to my feet, I began the laborious climb out of the pit. I had to get back to the camp.
Professor Challenger! Lord John! Professor Summerlee! Where are you?
My companions were gone. The cold light of dawn showed our camp wrecked, our effects scattered, and close to the smoldering ashes of our fire, the trampled grass was stained with blood. I was so stunned that for a time I think I must have nearly lost my reason. I have a vague recollection of rushing about through woods all round the empty camp, wildly calling their names. But no answer came back. It was 24 hours later, in the grey light of another dawn, when I was roused out of tortured sleep by a touch on my arm, and there in front of me, pale, wild-eyed, scratched, and blood-stained.
I say... Young fella.
Lord John!
Keep your voice down.
You're alive!
And if we want to stay alive, young fella, we'd better get a move on. Thank God they didn't damage the rifles.
Who didn't damage the rifles?
The ape men.
So that's it. What happened?
Well, it was early in the morning.
Yesterday morning?
Yes. Our learned friends were just stirring, hadn't even begun to argue yet. All of a sudden, it rained apes. They came down as thick as apples from a tree. I shot one of them through the belly.
I heard the shots.
But they had us down before we could move. Mind you, I call them apes, but... They carried sticks and stones. They jabbered to each other. Ended up by tying our hands with creepers.
The apes did that?
Apes or ape men, they're a kind of missing link, and I wish to God they'd stayed missing.
And then?
They carried off their wounded friend. He was bleeding like a pig.
Then it wasn't any of you. What about Challenger and Summerlee?
Now look here, young fella, there's no time to explain now. You take two of the rifles, I'll take the other two, and as much food and ammunition as you can cram into your pockets. Now hurry.
What for?
Anywhere away from this camp.
You mean...
They'll be heading straight for here as soon as they discover I've escaped. Now get a move on or we're done.
But Challenger and
Summerlee... I tell you, there is no time to explain now. Into the brush. Follow me. This ought to do. Keep down.
You think the apes are close to us?
Well, they'll have scouting parties all through the forest. You better load those guns.
But what happened?
Happened?
After the apes tied you up.
Oh, that's just it. Old Challenger managed to struggle onto his feet, tied up and all, and started raving at him like a lunatic. If there'd been a row of his favourite pressmen, he couldn't have slanged them worse. But that's the funny part of it. It was Challenger's looks that saved us.
Challenger's what?
Challenger's looks. When he began slanging them, I thought it was the end of us. But,
well,
they started jabbering themselves. Then one of them stood out beside Challenger. And word of honour, they might have been kinsmen.
What?
This old ape man, he was their chief, was a sort of red Challenger with every one of our friend's beauty points, only a trifle more so.
Challenger and the ape man?
That's right.
Did you point this out to the professor?
Well, dash it all, he must have seen that for himself.
I wonder.
When the ape man stood by Challenger, put its paw on his shoulder, the thing was complete. Summerlee was a bit hysterical. He laughed till he cried.
What about the ape man?
Well, they laughed too, or at least they put up the devil of a cackling. Then they set to work to drag us off through the forest. Summerlee and I got a bit of rough handling, but Challenger was all right. I mean, they carried him shoulder high, like a Roman emperor.
Duck down. Is that
ape men. Yes.
That's the row they make when they get excited.
Do we fire at them?
No, not unless they see us. We've got a surprise rescue to make.
Surprise rescue?
Oh, hello. They haven't seen us. I think they're going past.
What were you saying about a rescue?
Now, look here, young fellow, this next bit, it's not a bit pleasant.
Go on.
These apes, they've got a kind of town, huts made out of leaves and branches. Well, it's about 4 to 5 miles from here. It's near the edge of the cliff. Well, when we got there, they tied us up. The fellow who handled me could tie like a bosun, and there we lay with our toes up beneath a tree while a great brute stood guard over us with a club in his hand.
We?
Somebody and myself. Old Challenger was up a tree, eating pines, having the time of his life. If you'd seen him sitting up in that tree, hobnobbing with his twin brother.
I can guess, but you couldn't have found it very funny at the time.
Well, we weren't in much mood for laughing. They let Challenger do what he liked within limits, but they drew the line pretty sharply at Summerlee and me. It was a mighty consolation to us all to know that you were running loose, young fella. Had the archives in your keeping. Well, now I'll tell you what's going to surprise you.
I doubt whether I can be surprised at anything else, Lord John.
You say you saw signs of men and fires over in those caves by the lake?
Yes.
Well, we've seen the natives, little what? Down-faced chaps, like Indians. You see, it seems the humans hold one side of this plateau over yonder, where you saw the caves, and the ape men hold this side. And there's bloody war between them. Yesterday, the apes got hold of a dozen Indians, brought them in as prisoners. You never heard such a jabbering and shrieking in your life. The men were little red fellows. They'd been bitten and clawed so they could hardly walk. The ape men put 2 of them to death there and then. Fairly pulled the arm off one of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was perfectly beastly. Turned us absolutely sick, and the business afterwards, guy, it was awful. This morning there's to be another ceremony.
Ceremony? What do you mean?
You remember those sharp bamboo canes below the plateau? Where we found...
Well, we found the skeleton in
there.
That's
it.
You mean?
Yes. This town is the jumping-off place for prisoners. They chuck them over the edge there. The game is to see whether they're just dashed to pieces or they get skewered on the bamboo canes below. 6 of the Indians went yesterday, and this morning...
Not Challenger and Summerlee, too?
Summerlee for certain. Challenger, too, if they turn nasty.
And you?
Oh, I was included in the bill. It seemed to me our only chance was for me to get away, pick up the rifles, try a rescue. Well, now that you're here...
How soon will they...
I don't know. And that's why we'd better hurry.
2 men, 4 rifles. Can we do it?
We've got to do it, young fella. We've got to do it.
That ape town?
Yes. Part the bushes. Careful and look through.
An open space lay before us. All green turf and low bracken growing to the very edge of the cliff. Round this clearing was a semicircle of trees with huts built of foliage. The opening of these huts, the branches of the trees, were thronged with ape people. In the open near the edge of the cliff stood some 100 of these shaggy, red-haired creatures. And a little group of Indians stood among them, small and brown-skinned against their huge guards. That was when 2 of the ape guards darted forward towards one of the Indians. They caught him by the leg and arm. They swung him backwards, forwards, backwards again, and...
I can't stand this.
Easy now. Keep your hands off that trigger.
We can't let them go on with it.
We're not going to. Just pick your man before you start firing.
Look at them. Delighted as maniacs. Rushing to the edge to see whether...
See whether it was the ground or the bamboos, yes.
But where's Challenger? Where's Summerlee?
Well, there's Challenger. Can't you see him?
Good Lord, I didn't...
Recognize him from the apes? No.
Have we got a chance?
Yes, and more than a chance. Look, there.
What is it?
Indians, young fella. Pals of these poor devils on the edge of the clearing, creeping up for a surprise attack while the apes are occupied.
If we attack when the Indians do, we can drive the whole tribe straight over the edge of the cliff.
If we're lucky, yes.
Oh, John, it's too late. They've got Summerlee now.
Rifle up, my lad. Get ready.
But we can't fire into the middle of them. We might hit Summerlee.
That crowd will have to stand back when they begin to swing him. There.
Instructions?
You take the guard on the left. I'll take the guard on the right. Fire when I count three. One.
The Indians are creeping forward. I saw them move.
Never mind the Indians. Draw your sights on that guard. Two.
It's the Ape King himself who's got hold of Summerlee on one side. He's yours. You drill him. But they've swung that body for the third time. If you don't hurry up and give the order...
Three!
You've got him! You've got the Ape
King! Shoot into the thick of them! Go on, sonny, shoot!
Magazine after magazine we emptied, and with our four guns the two of us made horrible havoc. Both of Summerlee's guards were dead. He was staggering about like a drunken man. But Challenger seized him. A nightmare Challenger, with matted black beard and clothes in rags. And they ran towards us. Then, out of the woods, poured the Indians, with bows and spears for weapons, and the battle was joined.
Challenger! Summerlee, this way!
You think they can see us?
They see us all right. Keep on firing.
Professor Challenger!
Oh, you arrived, gentlemen. Almost too late.
It's not necessary to support me, sir. I'm quite capable of walking upright.
Not only we as individuals, but European science collectively owe you a deep debt of gratitude for what you've done. I do not hesitate.
You never mind that, old chap. Just here, here's a rifle. Use it. These Indians, they're as active as cats when they go in with a spear.
Mind their arrows, the place is humming with them.
Ah, I got a hit then, I distinctly got a
one
hit.
One last go may do it. Now step quick now and keep firing.
Forward the battle surged on the very edge of the plateau. Apemen and Indians, clubs against spears, rolled over together. Others broke towards the woods. The Indians might have gone down, crushed under clubs if it hadn't been for our rifles. Then in a moment came panic and collapse. Shrieking and howling, the ape men streamed in mad disorder towards the brushwood, with Indians in pursuit. The scream of battle soared just before it died away.
All right, my lads. That's done it.
Is it over?
All but the tidying up. The less we see of the tidying up, the better we're going to sleep.
You need not blench, Professor Summerlee. You need feel no regret at what has happened this day. I, George Edward Challenger, say that we have been privileged.
Privileged, sir?
Privileged, sir, to be present at one of the typical decisive battles of history. Of man against ape, of man against nature. And at last, man is supreme on the plateau.
Wait a minute.
What's wrong now?
There are a dozen Indians, important-looking fellas, too, coming back out of that wood. Coming towards us.
You don't think
they regard us as enemies?
We can't tell. Steady now.
Here. Wait a minute.
Good gracious.
Enemies, did you say?
Oh, John, the whole gang are going down on their knees, practically prostrating themselves. Can't you do anything?
Well, how in blazes can I talk to them?
But this is...
Oh, get up, little fella. No, take your face off me boots. Oh, hang it all.
This is certainly most distasteful. Don't you find it uncomfortable, Professor Challenger?
I, sir, find it most interesting.
Interesting, sir?
These Indians may be undeveloped types, it's true. But their deportment in the presence of their superiors might be a lesson to some of our more advanced Europeans. Strange how correct are the instincts of natural man.
What's that?
It's all right, young fella. It's only one of the Indians who hasn't seen Challenger before.
Hasn't seen me before?
Oh, take it easy, little chap. Don't run away. He's only human.
Really, sir?
Hang it all, man. It's lucky for you that you are a little out of the ordinary. You hadn't been so like the King of the Apes.
Oh, upon my word, Lord John, you allow yourself great latitude.
Well, it's a fact, ain't it?
I beg, sir, that you will change the subject. Your remarks are irrelevant and unintelligible. Mr. Malone.
Yes, sir?
You keep a diary of these events, I believe. You expect eventually to publish it?
That's right, sir.
You may have heard just now some rather fatuous remarks which seem to imply that there was some resemblance.
Yes, I heard them.
I need not say that any publicity given to such an idea any levity in your narrative would be exceedingly offensive to me.
I will keep well within the truth.
The King of the Ape-Man was really a creature of great distinction. A most remarkably handsome and intelligent personality. Didn't it strike you?
Most remarkable creature.
Is it any good, sir, arguing what Mr. Malone will or will not publish, when he will never return alive to publish it?
I beg your pardon, sir. I was about to announce, before this unmannerly interruption...
Well, sir?
...that I have already found a way down from the plateau.
You've already... Impossible. Do you know what you're saying, Hotep?
Perfectly well, Lord John.
A way down? But how?
You observed, I think, that I showed no sign of surprise at the homage of these intelligent Indians.
All right, what about it?
You also observe among them now a taller Indian, clearly a chief of some description.
The Indian to whom you refer was a captive with us among the apes. Well, sir?
Well, sir, it seemed obvious to me that centuries of contact between ape and human, if only the contact of warfare, must have developed some means of communication between them. By closely observing the sign language, I was easily able to imitate the ape. That is to say, I was able to establish a rude working means of communication with the Indian before you.
You don't mean you can talk these fellas' lingo?
No, but I flatter myself that we understand each other. Does Mr. Malone remember describing a line of caves on the other side of the plateau?
Yes. You mean...
The way down, gentlemen, lies in a tunnel leading from those caves.
How are you sure of this?
The Indian before you drew me what I believed to be a rough map of it. And I venture to predict... 24 hours more will see us safely on solid earth again.
Good God.
Back to England.
Back to civilization.
Back to Gladys.
Professor Challenger, this is inspiration.
Professor Summerlee, not at all.
We must start immediately.
Hold on a bit. We'll start fast enough, but not before I've had another look at that pterodactyl swamp.
Lord John, will you tell us the meaning of your constant references to the pterodactyl swamp?
Oh, in good time, old chap, in good time. But I say, Professor Summerlee, why on earth are you looking so uneasy?
For the first time, Lord John, I begin to have qualms.
Qualms? Why?
We have, if you recall, a report to make to the Zoological Institute.
I recall it.
We have travelled far into the unknown. But I asked the question before, and I ask it now in a new spirit. What will they say of this in England?
That, sir, remains to be seen. Meanwhile, I suggest that we begin making preparations for our departure with the utmost secrecy.
You mean...
I mean, sir, that it would perhaps be better if the Indians do not know what we are about. They might not take too kindly to our sudden departure. Now, here's what we shall do. Quietly gather together what belongings we now possess... plus one or two other small items, as may be necessary. And then, in 2 days from now, at dawn, while the Indians are still asleep, we shall endeavour to make our escape through the caves.
You nearly had me over.
Sorry. Well, this crate's damned heavy.
Yeah.
Perhaps if you were to lower your end slightly... that's better.
Come along, come along. Don't hang back.
Sorry, but this thing's heavy. What is it?
Wait and see. Now, hurry, hurry.
I can't see a thing. I do wish, Professor Challenger, that you wouldn't rush on so with the torch.
Well, keep up, sir. Listen. What's that?
Drums. Oh, that's torn it. They've discovered we're missing.
Blast!
Oh, what's...
It's pitch black! What's happening?
Oh, there's not the slightest need for panic. The torch has blown out. I shall relight it. There. Now, come along. Can't be much further. According to the map, it was only a... Oh.
What's the matter? Why, it's a dead end.
A cul-de-sac.
Then we're done.
No, we're not. Come back here, Professor.
What?
Don't you remember the map showed a small fork just before the tunnel ended? Just about here. No, no. Further back. Bring the torch, that's it. Just about where the torch blew out. Don't you see? The torch blew out.
By Jove, he's right. Look, the entrance to another tunnel.
Shall we try it?
We've no choice. Come on.
Look, what's that? Careful, Professor.
Challenge it, stop, I figure.
It's a wall of flame across the cave.
Then we're trapped.
Indeed we are not, gentlemen. It's the sun shining right into the mouth of the tunnel.
What? Then we're through, boys. We're through.
And so we were. And after a short descent by rope, we found ourselves at the foot of those sinister cliffs. Save for Challenger's mysterious luggage, we had no difficulties. Then we set out to locate Zambo's camp, only to find to our great delight that a rescue party had already arrived there. And shortly afterwards, we began the long journey home. And so we returned in triumph to England. Almost as soon as the liner docked at Southampton, we were hurried off, luggage and all, to London, there to attend the extraordinary meeting of the Zoological Institute, which was to be held at the Queen's Hall in Regent Street. We had agreed beforehand not to talk to reporters, other than to say that our expedition had been successful. And so, when we were eventually led onto the platform, we faced a packed hall with the audience in a high state of curiosity and excitement.
Well, young fella, seems 100 years ago since that last meeting, don't it? I say, you haven't heard a word I've been saying. What's up, nervous?
No, I'm sorry. I was just thinking, perhaps I should have contacted Gladys.
Oh, I see. Oh, I shouldn't worry if I were you. Give her a surprise. I'm told women like surprises.
Yes, but all the same, I think...
Fun's about to start, I think.
Professor Challenger.
Yes, Professor Summerhill.
I have observed a certain person in the audience, and the presence of this villain, I repeat, sir, villain, fills me with the greatest disquiet. Look at the aisle seat beside the stage.
I see him, Professor Summerhill. Surely that can only be the deplorable countenance of...
Yes.
Who is it?
Quiet, young fellow. The chairman's going to begin. Quiet.
Ladies and gentlemen. I shall not, ladies and gentlemen, stand for more than a moment between you and the treat which lies before you. It is not for me to anticipate what Professor Summerlee, the spokesman of this committee, has to say to you. It is common rumor, however, that their expedition has been crowned with extraordinary success. And I shall, without further ado, introduce to you the spokesman of the party, Professor Summerlee, F.R.S.
Did you hear, sir, a pun distinctly resembling a hiss?
I heard it.
Did you observe that it came from the person in the aisle seat?
Get up, old chap. Begin your speech.
Well, who is this villain in the aisle seat?
Get up, Professor. Get up.
But who is he? He may cause trouble. You can't mean it.
Young man, that is Dr. Illingworth of Edinburgh.
Professor Summerlee, F.R.S.
Ladies and gentlemen, many of you will no doubt remember that at the last meeting of the Society, Professor Challenger made certain observations regarding the supposed survival of certain prehistoric monsters and of a lost world. At that time also, you may remember... And in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, I have only this to say. These things are true. The pterodactyl, the iguanodon, the megalosaurus, and all forms of animal life I have described to you lived and had their being before our eyes. You have honored me with a deep silence following my words. What that silence may portend, I cannot tell. But I have been asked to render my report to this institute, and I have done so. Mighty is truth, and will prevail. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman!
That's Illingworth. He does mean trouble.
Steady now.
Mr. Chairman! Mr. Chairman!
Yes, Dr. Illingworth.
I believe that a resolution of thanks to these gentlemen is to be moved by Professor Sergius.
Yes, sir, that is so.
Is it not the procedure for an amendment to be taken before a resolution?
Yes, sir, if there must be an amendment.
Mr. Chairman, there must be an amendment.
May I ask, Mr. Chairman, whether I have leave to put Dr. Illingworth into the street?
For the love of Mike, easy. Illingworth's climbing up on the platform. That's done it.
Ladies and gentlemen of this audience, hear me. At a previous meeting of this society, one man, Professor Challenger, said certain things. Now four men say other and more startling things. I admit that the members of this committee are men of character, but even distinguished professors may be misled by the desire for notoriety. Heavy game shots like to cap the tails of their rivals, and journalists surely are not averse from sensational coups. Each member of this committee had his own desire to make the most of the results. I have no desire to be offensive.
You are, sir.
The corroboration of these wonderful tales is really of the most slender description. What does it amount to? Some photographs. Is it possible that such can be taken as evidence? What more? We have a story of a flight and a descent by ropes, which precluded the production of larger specimens. Ingenious, but not convincing. I understand that Lord John Roxton claimed to have the skull of an iguanodon. I can only say that I should like to see that skull.
Is this fella calling me a liar? Dr. Illingworth, I must direct you to bring your remarks to a conclusion and to move your amendment.
Now for the flight, young fellows. Challenger's on his feet. And he's got the gloves off.
You're certainly having an arresting effect on this mob. There was a free fight going on at the back.
Quiet, sonny, quiet.
It will be in the memory of many present that similar foolish and unmannerly scenes marked the last meeting at which I made an address. On that occasion, Professor Summerlee was the chief offender. Though he is now chastened and contrite, the matter cannot be entirely forgotten. I have heard tonight similar, but even more offensive sentiments from the person who has just sat down. And though it is a conscious effort of self-effacement to come down to that person's mental level, I will endeavor to do so. I have safely conducted these three gentlemen to the spot mentioned, and I have, as you have heard, convinced them of the accuracy of my previous account. We had hoped to find on our return that no one was so dense as to dispute our joint conclusions. Warned, however, by my previous experience, I have not come without such proofs as may convince a reasonable man. Eight men ransacked our camp, and most of our photographic negatives were ruined.
Tell us another one.
In mentioning ape men, I cannot forbear from saying that some of the sounds which now meet my ears bring back most vividly to my recollection my experience with those interesting creatures. In spite of the destruction of so many invaluable negatives, there still remains in our collection a certain number of corroborative photographs showing the conditions of life upon the plateau. We could only bring with us a limited amount of luggage, but Professor Summerlee's collection of butterflies and beetles and many new species is intact. Is this not evidence?
No!
Who said no?
Our point is that such a collection might have been made in other places than a prehistoric plateau.
No doubt, sir, we have to bow to your scientific authority, although I must admit, the name is unfamiliar. Passing, then, both the photographs and the entomological collection, I come to the varied and accurate information which we bring with us upon points which have never before been elucidated. For example, upon the domestic habits of the pterodactyl. I say that upon the domestic habits of the pterodactyl, we can throw a flood of light. I can exhibit to you from my portfolio a picture of that creature, taken from life, which would convince you.
No picture could convince us of anything.
You would require to see the thing itself, Dr. Illingworth?
Certainly.
And you would accept that?
Beyond a doubt.
Then came the sensation of the evening, an event unparalleled in the history of scientific gatherings. Professor Challenger raised his hand in the air as a signal. Lord John Roxton rose to his feet immediately and made his way to the back of the platform, and with Zambo, our faithful Negro servant, he dragged forward a packing case. There wasn't a sound in the hall, and all eyes were fixed on the case. Professor Challenger slid the lid open. Peering down into the box, he snapped his fingers several times.
Come then, pretty. Come on, pretty, pretty. Come along, pretty.
Oh! Even the unexpected fall of the chairman into the orchestra pit failed to distract the petrified attention of the vast audience. A pterodactyl, for such it was, though a baby one, glared upon them with malicious red eyes, as bright as points of burning coal. Its long, savage mouth showed a double row of pointed teeth, its shoulders were humped, and its folded wings were draped round them like a faded grey shawl. It was the devil of everyone's childhood in person.
No, I can't reach it. It's flying straight towards the balcony.
The window! For heaven's sake, shut the window!
Too late, old chap. It's gone.
Suddenly it seemed that everyone was on his feet. Everyone was moving, shouting, gesticulating. A dense crowd of cheering students surged round us. My three companions were hoisted shoulder high. In vain they strove to break loose. I managed to get away in the melee, and I watched them as they were carried out through the main doors and out into the street. It seemed that thousands of people were waiting, blocking the streets from side to side. The crowd set forth, down Regent Street, Pall Mall, St. James's Street, and Piccadilly. And it was not until after midnight that the travellers were released at the entrance to Lord John Roxton's chambers in the Albany. Meanwhile, I managed to slip away, for I had a most important call to make in Streatham.
Yes, what is it?
Gladys. Gladys. Don't you recognise me? It's Ned. Ned Malone.
Yes, I recognise you, Ned. What do you want?
Who is it, Gladys?
Gladys, listen. What's the matter? You are Gladys Hungerton, aren't you?
No, Ned. I am Gladys Potts. Let me introduce you to my husband. Come in, won't you?
You? What?
My husband. William? Didn't you get my letter?
No. I got no letter.
Oh, what a pity, Ned. It would have made everything quite clear.
Yes. What is it, dear?
I think it is quite clear.
This is my husband, William Potts, Ned Malone. I'm very sorry about this, Ned. But your love couldn't have been very deep, could it? If you could go off to the other end of the world and leave me here alone. Well, say something, will you?
No offence, Mr. Malone.
It's always like this, ain't it? And must be, unless you have polygamy, only the other way round. You're not angry, are you?
No, not at all. But may I ask you a question?
Well, within reason.
How did you do it?
Do what?
Have you searched for a hidden treasure, or discovered a continent, or what? How did you get the glamour of romance?
Don't you think all this is a little personal, Mr. Malone?
Well, just one question. What do you do? What's your profession?
I'm a solicitor's clerk, the second man at Johnson & Merivale's 41 Chancery Lane.
Thank you. My friends are waiting. Good night.
It was a little later that night when Challenger and Summerlee and Lord John and I sat around the table in Lord John's rooms.
The fact is, you fellas, I've been saving up a bit of a surprise.
Surprise, Lord John?
Oh, of what nature, may one inquire? To surprise the mind of George Edward Challenger.
Well, this will surprise you, old chap. You remember back on the platter how interested I was in the pterodactyl swamp?
Well, it was to get the pterodactyl, surely.
It was the unfortunate specimen which has escaped us forever.
Yes, but that wasn't all. You remember I said the pit was a volcanic vent full of blue clay?
I remember it well. Why?
There's only one place in the world would have seen the same thing, and that was... Hold on now. The great De Beers diamond mine of Kimberley. Mm-hmm. I had several goes at the place, and this is what I found.
Diamond?
This little lot, I had them valued at para. It's worth a minimum of £200,000. Oh. Of course, it's fair shares among us. I won't hear anything else, mind.
This is most generous.
It's nothing of the kind. What'll you do with your 50,000, old chap?
Well, if you really persist, Lord John, I should found a private museum. The George Edward Challenger Museum.
And you, Summerlee?
I should retire from teaching in order to research.
I'll use mine, I think, for another expedition to the dear old plateau. And you, young fellow, because you'll be getting married.
Not yet, Lord John. Not just yet.
Not just yet?
That's it. And I'm not altogether sure it's not a good thing. I think, if you'll allow me, I'd rather come along with you. So, in humble and thankful mood, I close this account. Our eyes have seen great wonders, and our souls are chastened by what we have endured, each in his own way, a better and a deeper man.
In the final episode of The Lost World by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, adapted for radio by Peggy Wells and Barry Campbell, Professor Challenger was played by Francis DeWolf, Edward Malone by Kevin McHugh, Lord John Roxton by Gerald Harper, and Professor Summerlee by Carlton Hobbs. Chairman Dennis McCarthy, Dr. Illingworth, Hector Ross, Gladys, Carol Boyd, William Potts, John Bull. Special effects were by the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and other effects by Janet Mitchell and David Greenwood. Technical assistance was by Jock Farrell, and the serial was produced by Betty Davis.